Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Immunity passports have been proposed as one way to get economies fired up again. These passports would rely on an antibody test, the theory being if you have antibodies to the coronavirus, you might be immune, and therefore you could be certified to work and circulate in society without posing a risk to yourself or to others. At least that's the idea, but this idea has a lot of flaws, according to bioethicist Natalie Koeffler. She wrote about it in the journal Nature and joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. First of all, who is interested in using these so-called immunity passports? Are we talking about governments, private companies, both?
Both at this point. We've heard about certain governments that are exploring immunity passports as a potential policy to help reopen economies. Governments including the UK, the United States, as well as Chile has actually already begun to sort of roll out a version of an immunity passport. Mm. Private companies are also interested, particularly in partnering with certain app developers to create applications that would allow for people on their phones to validate and show their immunity status, and in which case that could allow private companies like certain hotels and even sporting events to control who can enter their premises.
Okay, well, let's talk about a few of the concerns that you raise in your article. First, there's this whole issue of immunity itself. I'm curious, does having antibodies to COVID-19 mean you are actually immune to another infection by the virus?
So having antibodies to COVID-19 means that you have survived the virus, right?
Right.
You've been infected and recovered. Likely this gives some immunity to future infection. However, scientists still don't know how that immunity might work, meaning we don't know if everybody who has survived has a robust enough immune response to be able to prevent future infection. Mm-hmm. We also don't know if immunity is possible from COVID-19, then how long it might last. If it's anything like the coronavirus that causes the common cold, immunity might last for only as little as, 4 to 6 months.
Wow.
If it's like other coronaviruses, it could last longer, like the SARS virus could give you immunity maybe for 1 to 2 years.
Right. What about the tests that even test for antibodies? I mean, do we even have enough of those tests, and are they reliable enough to support a whole system of immunity passports?
So one concern of ours is that there's currently real issues of the reliability of available tests for antibodies.
Mm-hmm.
There are some available that do have high enough sensitivity and specificity to be able to use as a measure for antibodies within people trying to determine their potential immune status.
Mm-hmm.
The problem there, though, is, again, a numbers issue. So there's only very few manufacturers of highly reliable tests. Roche is one of them out of Switzerland, for example. And right now, for example, they're guaranteeing, several million tests a month to be produced, but that's going to be nowhere near enough to be able to validate entire, populations.
Yeah.
of nations for their immune status.
Well, another issue that you raise is this whole idea of equity, that the poor will simply not have as much access to these immunity passports. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so we're really concerned about knowing that immunity assessment through these antibody tests is going to be dependent on how many tests are available, and knowing that those tests are going to be a scarce resource. Those that are already marginalized by society, the poor, minority groups, they end up to being often last in line for access to these precious resources. And
right.
So we have a lot of concern about who would actually be able to have their immunity status validated. You could have people that just aren't able to access society because they can't even be able to certify their immune status.
Well, then, given that there are several concerns with immunity passports, they may not be the answer. What is then?
So I really think attention needs to be given right now to really developing a vaccine that is effective, but also that is going to be universally available. And I also do support maybe thinking about ways that we can protect particularly vulnerable locations and spaces. So it may be that, for example, to enter certain nursing homes or long care facilities or to enter certain penitentiaries where there's high density people who are going to be at higher risk of COVID-19, that we might have health check status there, right? We may want to check for, you know, presence of virus in people who are entering and exiting, but not on the individual level where everybody is going to either have, you know, an immunoprivileged sort of status or immunodeprived status to be able to depend on where and what they can go do. I think that that could create a lot more harm than it does good.
Bioethicist Natalie Koeffler is also an advisor for the Scientific Citizenship Initiative at Harvard Medical School. This was so interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
As states continue to move toward reopening, today the Navajo Nation emerged from a strict weekend lockdown and police-enforced curfew, its seventh so far. Native Americans have been experiencing disproportionately high rates of infection and death from COVID-19. In this report, part of our series, Race Matters, Stephanie Tsai explains that even smaller tribes consider the pandemic an existential threat.
Ground zero for COVID-19 cases in New Mexico is the town of Gallup on the edge of the Navajo Nation.
I'm like, well, we live in Gallup. It's not going to come here.
Navajo nurse Kelly Manuelito treated the first COVID-positive patient to arrive at Rehoboth McKinley Christian Healthcare Services. She works in the intensive care unit.
A lot of Native families, there are at least 5 or 6 to 8 to 10 people living in one household. And it's really disheartening to see that it can spread so easily.
The staff of the ICU was overwhelmed when they saw a spike in COVID patients in late April, tied to an outbreak among the homeless population.
It's definitely scary. I don't know one single worker who is not scared to come up. We've been working extra hours, extra days, and it's been really rough.
She says she's been able to take a break in recent days. The New Mexico governor lifted a week-long lockdown after fewer cases were recently reported. But the toll has been devastating on Native peoples in New Mexico. They account for 50% of all of the state's COVID-19 deaths, even though they make up only 11% of the population.
I grew up in the northwestern part of New Mexico.
Jordan Bennett Begay, a reporter for Indian Country Today, spends hours a day compiling reports of Native American COVID cases and deaths. It's a stark spreadsheet that tells a sad, still unfolding story.
There was a point where one day I counted there are 60 people in our database. That night after recording like 10 deaths in one day, I broke down. I did cry because then these are, you know, my relatives.
Relative has an expansive definition in Indian country. And on April 23rd, Valentina Blackhorse, a former Miss Western Navajo, was added to that list. Blackhorse lived in Kayenta, and her boyfriend, a correctional officer, had the virus. One day after she tested positive, she died at 28 years old.
I never thought she would get sick because, you know, she kept telling us, you know, stay home, wash your hands, wear your mask.
Danielle Blackhorse spoke to us a week after her big sister was laid to rest.
How a funeral should be, it wasn't like that. There was no chairs. My mom couldn't get comfort from her family. We had to stay in our vehicles until, you know, they covered her. I'm heartbroken. It seems like a part of me has been ripped away.
In an effort to save Native American lives, tribal leaders have taken strict measures, including curfews and roadblocks. And in Washington state, the Lummi Nation has been uniquely proactive in testing its 5,300 members.
Everyone stay in their own homes and avoid interaction with your family members.
Springing into action after the first case in the U.S. was announced at a locale 1 hour away from the reservation.
So then we start putting orders everywhere that we could think of.
Dr. Christina Toledo Cornell is the public health director for the tribe. Besides ordering testing materials and medical equipment early on, they have been aggressively contact tracing.
So to us, it was very important to find every single case, because if we miss one or two, that could be catastrophic for a lot of people. And that allowed us to really be aggressive in terms of relaxing the testing criteria and doing as many tests as we could.
As a result, they've had dozens of confirmed cases, but no deaths. Back in New Mexico, there are significant clusters of cases in the state's pueblos. By one estimate, 11% of the Zia reservation of only 646 members were infected. At that rate, leaders are concerned about the risk of extinction.
We've been through this before with the Spanish flu, you know, back in the early 1900s. The Pueblo of Pewaukee was reduced to just a few individuals.
Joseph Talachi is governor of the Pueblo of Pewaukee.
Our history is passed down through our language and through our spoken stories. And so any loss of our tribal elders would be a loss to our history.
He shut down the Pueblo early.
I knew that there was going to be consequences to that as well. You know, people were going to be upset.
The Buffalo Thunder Casino Hotel is closed for business and instead being used to house COVID-19 patients from other area tribes. Casino closures since the pandemic are expected to directly affect basic services on tribal lands.
But it just takes a few mistakes to get this virus to peak back up, especially in Indian country.
An economy doesn't mean anything if you don't have people.
In northern Michigan, Brian Newland is the tribal chairperson of the Bay Mills Indian community.
This pandemic's impact on our community has been almost entirely economic at this point. I would estimate that right now we have about two-thirds of our tribal employees out of work. And then our tribe has a pretty sizable commercial fishing industry that's really been hit hard.
Back on the Navajo Nation, Karen Schell has felt that economic hit, too. She runs a shop that's been in the family since 1948 and has been closed for months.
I have just hundreds and hundreds of Navajo people that sell to me.
Lost business for her means lost revenue for her local chapter house.
Those monies go to our community here. I'm not making anything. They're not getting anything.
But she says just down the road from her shop, fellow Navajo have died.
We know them by name, and we know people who are sick right now. So I think everybody on the reservation knows somebody who is sick.
Nurse Kelly Manulito, while taking care of the sick, has been struggling herself.
I understand you're a mother and have had to distance from your own child.
I have. It's been the hardest thing to be away from her. Her name is Hayden. She is 5. For the past 5 years and 9 months of her life, I have told her every day, come hug mommy, come kiss mommy. My mission as a nurse is I am here to protect, and my job as a mother is to keep my daughter safe, to keep her surrounded by family and love.
Many will say it's that kinship that has helped Native people survive throughout time and against all odds. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai in Phoenix.
Decades ago, I said that, you know, I didn't know much about Brazil, still don't. But from what I heard from people who had been there, or people who were from there, because I'd heard a long time ago that outside of Africa, the largest population of black people is in Brazil. But you don't ever see them on television, even on the Brazilian programs. It's every now and then, I mean, somebody will pan the camera and you'll spot them on the, at Mardi Gras time. But where are they the rest of the time when they make the advertisements and do all the hoopla and whatnot? You wouldn't think that it's, you know, it was just, you would think that there's just a smattering of black people in Brazil. I mean, when I say black people that look like black people in Central Africa. Mm-hmm. But the numbers are huge. But they all push back up in those hills. But when it comes to classification, from what I understand, Brazilians will tell you, we don't have any discrimination here. You know, everybody's the same. Cola don't make no difference here. This is Brazil.
The U.S. is the undisputed leader in a contest no one wants to win. This country has by far more reported cases of the coronavirus than any other nation in the world. The number now tops 1.6 million people. Second on the list, not a country in Asia where the virus first appeared, or in Europe where hotspots erupted in March and April. Brazil now holds the world's number two tally of cases, and the U.S. just banned nearly all travel from Brazil. NPR's Philip Reeves is in Rio de Janeiro and joins us now. Hey, Phil.
Hi.
So give us an idea of how things are in Brazil right now.
Well, things are bleak, and they're getting bleaker. The authorities are having a real struggle to get people to stay off the streets, to stay home, and to wear masks. We've been seeing social isolation generally weaken, even as infections and deaths are soaring. And it's no longer about cities and towns here anymore. COVID-19 is also spreading into Brazil's interior, including deep into the Amazon rainforest. Indigenous people there are dying in alarming numbers. For a lot of them, the nearest hospital capable of handling a serious case of COVID-19 is often hundreds of miles away.
Right.
And, and in large parts of the country, health systems are hanging by a thread. I mean, in this city, Rio, where I am right now, there's an alarming shortage of intensive care beds. And in the public health system, reportedly, there isn't one vacant bed. The authorities here are supposed to have erected some field hospitals and have them up and running by now, but almost all of these have been delayed. So the situation is really worrying, and it's really worrying particularly for the most vulnerable members of the population, people who live in favelas, the heavily crowded, low-income neighborhoods where community officials are reporting several hundred deaths.
Well, Brazil's President Jair Bolsonaro has long derided the coronavirus. He's called it the little flu. Does it seem like he's changed his tune as the cases keep mounting there?
No, he hasn't changed his tune. He's against broad isolation because the economy's crashing and he wants people to get back to work. That's one thing. But Bolsonaro is also systematically subverting social distancing. On Saturday, he left the presidential palace in the capital, Brasilia, to stop at a hot dog stall where people, of course, began to gather around him, as he knew they would. Yesterday, he came out again to greet a crowd of supporters and dived in without a mask. He seems to relish attracting headlines with this sort of swaggering behavior. He's shown very little sympathy for victims. The other day, he remarked that more Brazilians are dying of fear than from the virus. Now, to handle a national emergency of these unprecedented dimensions, you need consensus, you need leadership, you need unity. Bolsonaro seems to be contriving to achieve the exact opposite. And remember, he's lost two health ministers in a month. The job is now being done by a stand-in, a general from the army.
Wow. Well, this travel ban from the U.S., I mean, how big of a blow is that to Bolsonaro? Because he has long boasted he has close ties to the Trump administration. So how has he interpreted this latest move?
Well, officials from the Bolsonaro government are shrugging it off. They point out that President Trump's barred entry to other countries that are allies, including the British, European nations, and so on, and that this is not about bilateral relations or diplomacy. It's about trying to contain a global pandemic, and lots of countries in this region have shut their borders. Some of Bolsonaro's opponents, however, particularly on the left, are honing in on this. They're portraying it as a humiliating snub. They've long been critical of Bolsonaro's deep admiration for President Trump and at his decision to realign Brazil's foreign policy by tilting it strongly in Washington's direction. They don't believe Brazil's benefiting sufficiently from that, and they cite this as another example.
Well, that is NPR's Philip Reeves in Rio. Thank you so much, Phil.
You're welcome.
Alabama is facing a coronavirus crisis right now. The state has nearly 15,000 confirmed cases. About a third of those are from the past 2 weeks alone, according to the state's public health department. According to one tracker, Alabama is now outpacing 46 other states and the District of Columbia in new cases. Dr. David Thrasher is seeing what this spike looks like firsthand.
Well, it's pretty tough. The numbers in Alabama and the numbers in Montgomery are steadily going up.
He's the chief of staff at Jackson Hospital in the city of Montgomery.
Last weekend, when I was on call, we saw 140 patients, which is twice our normal volume this time of year. Now, the hospitals per se are hurting.
It's gotten so bad that hospitals in Montgomery are sending coronavirus patients out of the county for treatment. Thrasher says many of the patients are actually young.
Well, I thought we had kind of escaped the surge, but it's come back with a vengeance in the last 3 weeks.
If the situation at Jackson Hospital sounds dire, that's the story all over the city of Montgomery. Yesterday, only 6 ICU beds were available across the health system. Last week, 1 intensive care unit bed was available. The mayor of Montgomery, Stephen Reed, says things are at crisis levels at a time when the state has been easing restrictions. And Mayor Reed joins us on the line this morning. Mayor, thanks for the time.
Always a pleasure.
What are you hearing from hospitals like Jackson Hospital in terms of what they need most in this moment?
Right now, what I'm hearing is that they're looking for us to sound the alarm and to let people know we're still in the middle of a pandemic and that we are in a health crisis and that they're running short on PPEs. They're running short, obviously, on beds and that, you know, the staffs are physically and emotionally spent. So we have to do our part as leaders in the community to make sure we get the public to understand this is not over. We have not won the battle with COVID-19 yet. And we have to continue some of the things that we were doing just a couple of months ago by staying at home, wearing masks when in public, and practicing all of these sanitary guidelines that have been handed down by the CDC.
Have you been seeing people in the city social distancing, wearing masks? I mean, are residents taking those precautions?
I think some are. I think some have decided that the pandemic is over and they're ready to get back to their normal way of doing things and they're willing to take the risk. Unfortunately, it's not just themselves that they put at risk when they do that. They put members of the public, their friends, family, colleagues at risk, and certainly our first responders and those medical professionals who are also doing, you know, just a great job and have been over the last couple of months.
Is there something that makes your city more vulnerable? Like, where do you think this spike is coming from right now?
You know, we can't point to any one particular place or a flashpoint, if you will. I think what makes us vulnerable is the fact that we're the regional healthcare center for Central Alabama. And so we have people that come from as far away as 90, 100 miles to our healthcare system. So we're getting people from everywhere. And certainly I think here in Montgomery, we've had people who again have relaxed their approach and have relaxed their practices and aren't adhering to social guidelines anymore.
Well, I know the governor, Kay Ivey, has moved ahead with lifting restrictions in the state, despite some concerns that you've expressed. I mean, do you have the authority and are you planning to maybe put stricter measures back in place in your city?
After a 240% increase month over month in COVID cases, we're planning to do whatever we have to do in order to change this trend. And we have limited authority, unfortunately, as mayor, but there are things that we can do from mandating masks, which we've been encouraging for well over 2 months, making that in a city ordinance, to also maybe looking at other ways to tighten the faucet, so to speak. So we're going to try to do what we can if we don't see these numbers change here in the next few days.
So next few days, I mean, what is the process? I mean, do you have to like go to city council and get that ordinance passed and signed and announce it and get it out there? I mean, it sounds like you really are at a crisis moment where actions like those might be needed.
Absolutely. We need to go to the council and have that discussion with them. But we're prepared to do that. We've already had some of those discussions and we're watching the numbers each day. And we're talking with our medical professionals in this community and our hospital CEOs to also get their feedback as well about the ongoing conditions.
All right. Again, speaking to Stephen Reed, the mayor of Montgomery, Alabama, his city and the state of Alabama seeing a real crisis moment as cases of coronavirus have been increasing in recent days. Mayor, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
This the city of Chicago.
You hear the message every day, wash your hands to help stop the spread of coronavirus. But how can you do that if you don't have water in your home? WBEZ's Maria Inez Zamudio brings us the story.
Bernal Green is lightly opening a fire hydrant, just enough so that he can get a good stream of water into his container.
This is how I get my water.
Green is in his 60s. Once he's collected enough, he turns off the hydrant and walks slowly carrying a big bottle of water.
The big Dixie bottle, I fills it up daily. You know, to wash dishes, flush toilet.
For years, Green has rented an apartment on the south side. During a harsh Chicago winter 2 years ago, the pipes burst in his apartment building. The water was disconnected to fix the pipes. But the pipes were never fixed, and the water stopped flowing for good.
I need water until I can move.
But that won't happen anytime soon. He's unemployed and looking for work during a time when millions of Americans have lost their jobs during the pandemic. His neighbor, Sheila Johnson, is renting an apartment in a building that houses 8 people. They, too, live without water.
It's a lot of people that don't have water.
Johnson is 68 and lives with her husband, Stephen. They moved into the property in January. Everything was fine when they moved in, but then the water was turned off. Johnson said she thinks the building is in foreclosure, and the landlord was in the process of selling the property before the pandemic. Living without water has been challenging. Johnson relies on neighbors, libraries, and park districts to get water or use the bathroom. This challenging situation has turned into a nightmare during the pandemic.
I can't wash my hands. I use wipes all day, sanitizer. And that's not doing like water. Nothing cleans like water.
Last week, city officials told WBEZ residents without water should call the finance department and enroll in a payment plan to get their water restored. But this is not a solution for Green and Johnson. Since many renters in Chicago don't have their water bills in their name, they rely on their landlords to pay their water bills. That leaves renters like Green and Johnson stuck without water during the pandemic. Johnson says she's glad community groups like Blacks in Green and Elevate Energy are distributing free bottled water.
So we're trying to make connections with people in the community today who may need assistance with helping to get that water cut back on.
That's Naomi Davis with Blacks in Green. She organized a water distribution event on Saturday, a few blocks from Johnson's apartment. Davis wants Mayor Lori Lightfoot to come up with a plan to identify Chicagoans living without water and restore services. Davis said Mayor Lightfoot's heart is in the right place, but she questions whether the Chicago Water Department is committed to restoring services in Black neighborhoods, which have been hit the hardest by water shutoffs and deaths from COVID-19. In 2017, the Water Department was cited by the city's inspector general for, quote, an unrestricted culture of overtly racist and sexist behavior and attitudes.
The troubling people in the Chicago Water Department who over the decades have demonstrated a contempt for Black people that is fully and well documented.
Davis is collecting information from people who don't have water and hopes she can help them restore water services. But until the city prioritizes restoring water to Chicagoans, Davis and other water advocates will continue distributing free bottled water. Maria Inez Zamudio, WBEZ News.
After 100,000, what happens when the counter strikes 100,000? Nothing. 100,000 American dead. That means, for all intents and purposes, nothing much. But does the counter stop counting? Or does it continue rolling on like the mighty Mississippi River? Is 100,000 an end, or just another number? And as summer begins to emerge, and people rush out of doors to get some socializing in, what happens in the next 2 weeks? A spike? A dozen spikes? It must be said that even as the official number strikes 100,000, the official number isn't the real one. For the U.S. is so stingy with testing that thousands of people, some who died at home, were never tested. How many homeless people have died? And do you really think they get tested? In times like these, all people are not created equal. For Black folks, this has been a time of ineffable loss. for many, many workers. Cleaners, nurses, orderlies, bus drivers, cab drivers, and the like. Their work was on the front lines of the contagion and the coronavirus. As America now opens its doors, what will they find? A new day or more death? From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
A march is underway right now in the downtown core to protest anti-black and anti-indigenous racism. CP24's Chanel Call joins us live with more. First off, Chanel, I hope you're in a safe place and able to give us a report. It's also a good time to remind everyone that's watching that we here at CP24 do our best to keep our viewers informed of what's happening in our city and raise awareness to the issues that are affecting people. But putting your hands on reporters is unacceptable and is considered assault. On that note, Chanel, what is the latest where you are?
Well, I'll just explain to you and our viewers what happened. It was quite chaotic. We were sort of in the middle of this protest that you see behind us here. And I'll note that a Toronto police officer that I just spoke with about half an hour ago told me there are 3,500 or more people here. Of course, we know large gatherings are not allowed at this time because of the COVID-19 pandemic. But people are gathering here. Organizers, before all of this happened, ask people to please wear a mask and as much as you can social distance. That's not really possible because of the crowd that you see behind us here. And during that last live hit with you, Jamie, we got a bit caught up in the middle of that crowd. We're unable to get out. People began getting a little bit aggressive. It was quite chaotic in the middle of that crowd. This is quite a passionate protest, and it has to do with 29-year-old Regis Korchinski-Paquette. Jamie, many of our viewers have heard this name this week. She is the 29-year-old who fell from her High Park balcony this week. Police were inside her home when that happened. Now there are questions about exactly what happened in the moments before she fell off her balcony. Her family, Jamie, saying that they believe police could have been involved in her death. They also believe police could have prevented her death. This protest today, we're told, is community-driven, not organized specifically by Regis's family. But they want to see justice for Regis. They also want to see a full investigation. Now, I had a chance to speak with Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders about an hour ago. He was here just steps away from Christie Pitts Park before we began moving down Bloor Street. Here's more of what he had to say.
I just want to make sure that everything's okay. We're looking for as peaceful a protest as possible. You know what? When we look around and see the things that are happening, ideally, we hope that there's an opportunity that people take the time to hear everything and base their actions on the truth and then figure out where, collectively as a city, we can move forward.
Chief, how do you feel hearing people screaming, same?
Oh, they're allowed for lawful protest. And so everyone's allowed for lawful protest. So I'll just head out.
So, Jamie, once again, thousands of folks you can see in front of us here on Bloor Street moving from Christie Pitts Park to Queen's Park. There's also quite a heavy police presence here keeping an eye on the protesters. Everyone wants to see this protest remain peaceful. You saw just moments ago things got quite chaotic, quite heated. This is a very hot button issue, Jamie. So that's why you see some of these protesters quite fueled up. We are trying to keep a safe distance away from the protesters now. It looks like they're doing some kind of chanting there. Once again, a lot of these signs say Black Lives Matter, Justice for Regis. We'll continue to follow this story for you, and we will bring you the latest on this in a few moments. For now, it's back to you, Jamie.
We appreciate that report, and yes, please stay safe for us, Chanel. Thank you so much. And the family of Regis Korchinski-Paquette released a statement through their lawyer ahead of today's protest. It reads in part, Today's 2 p.m. protest at Christie Pitts is not planned or organized by the family. The family is thankful for the outpouring of support from the community and to the organizers of today's event for bringing attention to this very serious matter. The family asks that anyone attending today's event observe social distancing bylaws to ensure those attending are safe and remain peaceful in honor of Regis.
The man, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
Incident in New York's Central Park this weekend was caught on video and went viral. A black man was out bird watching. He asked a white woman to put her dog on a leash. And then he shot a video of the dog owner threatening to call the police on him. Jen Chung is an editor at The Gothamist, part of member station WNYC, and she's here with me now to explain what happened before and during this video and the consequences later. Hey, Jen.
Hi.
Hi. So can you start by just telling us, how did this whole confrontation get started?
So Christian Cooper is a writer and an editor. He's also a bird watcher. He's on the board of directors at the New York City Audubon, and he also happens to be black. He says he spotted a woman with her unleashed dog on Sunday morning in the Ramble, a 36-acre area of Central Park where dogs have to be on leash. Mm-hmm. And bird watchers and other nature lovers have this issue with off-leash dogs and their owners all the time. So here's the beginning of the video that Christian Cooper took of their argument.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop.
Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop recording me.
Please don't come close to me.
Please take your phone off.
Please don't come close to me.
And I'm taking a picture and calling the cops.
Please call the cops. Please call the cops.
I'm going to tell them there's an African-American man threatening my life.
Please tell them whatever you like.
So, as we heard on that video, the dog owner said she would call the police on him, which she did, and tell them that an African-American man was threatening her life. But in the video, he's staying away at a distance, and he even says, don't come close to me. Still, later on, he tells the 911 operator, I'm being threatened by a man in Central Park. Please send the cops immediately.
Right. Okay. And then how did tens of millions of people end up seeing this video?
Christian Cooper shared it on Facebook, and then his sister shared it on Twitter. And also, you know, the convergence of bird Twitter and black Twitter, you know, I think it became widely circulated because it was another unfortunate example of what black people face on a regular basis. And in this incident, the video appears to show a white woman trying to weaponize the police and exert power over a black man who pointed out she was breaking the rules.
Right. She was the one breaking the rules at that point. Now, this woman has since been identified. Can you just tell us a little bit about her?
Right. The internet is a big place, but it also can be a small place. And they recognized her as Amy Cooper, no relation to Christian Cooper. And by the end of Sunday night, her employer, Franklin Templeton, an asset management firm, put her on administrative leave. Also, the dog rescue organization where she got her dog announced that Amy Cooper surrendered her Cocker Spaniel mix. And in the video, another alarming detail you see is that she's dragging her dog by the collar.
Right. And the dog is clearly struggling for air. Now, has Christian Cooper talked about why he decided right then and there in that moment to film this entire interaction?
He told our local NBC affiliate that he did not want to participate in his own dehumanization and pointed out this is a moment when people are making assumptions about black people and black men like Ahmaud Arbery being gunned down while running. The National Audubon Society also released a statement saying that black Americans often face terrible daily dangers in outdoor spaces where they are subjected to unwarranted suspicion, confrontation, and violence. The outdoor and the joy of birds should be safe and welcoming for all people. They also added, we are grateful Christian Cooper is safe. He takes great delight in sharing New York City's birds with others and serves as a board member of the New York City Audubon Society, where he promotes conservation of New York City's outdoor spaces and inclusion of all people.
And meanwhile, Amy Cooper, the woman at the center of this, she has since said a few things publicly about the incident. Can you tell us what she's shared?
Right. She has apologized and called her actions unacceptable and indefensible, and that she didn't mean to harm the man in any way. But she also said that she's not a racist, though Mayor Bill de Blasio called the incident racism pure and simple. And just this afternoon, her employer, Franklin Templeton, announced they conducted an internal review and decided to fire her, saying that they do not tolerate racism of any kind.
All right, Jen Chung is the executive editor at Gothamist, the digital arm of WNYC. Thank you, Jen.
The man, race, class, genre, and the dilemmas of black manhood.
The community of Glynn County, Georgia, is facing the fallout after the shooting death of a black man, Ahmaud Arbery. A viral video showed him jogging, being chased by two white men before being shot to death. For member station WABE, Emma Hurt reports the killing has brought up questions in Arbery's community about corruption in the criminal justice system and also racism.
On a recent Saturday, hundreds of people gathered on the steps of the Glynn County Courthouse. They wore masks, braving a pandemic beneath the live oaks and Spanish moss.
Justice for Ahmaud! Justice for Ahmaud!
Normally, Brunswick is a quiet coastal city with a sea breeze, but these days it's the subject of national outrage. John Perry, the president of the local NAACP chapter, spoke at the rally.
As I sit here and I look at you all, I see the beginning of a great awakening. An awakening that acknowledges that there's been a lot of darkness for a long, long time. But Ahmaud's death sounded off an alarm.
An alarm and awakening in this community, which many others have experienced in recent years.
And we've got to demand of our justice system to be to us what it promised to be.
Sitting on a ledge nearby, speaking through a mask, was Glynn County Commissioner Alan Booker. The only black member of the county commission, he represents most of Glynn's African-American community, which is just over a quarter of the population. And his nephew's best friend, Ahmaud Arbery.
It is the most horrifying display of hatred that I know personally I've ever seen, but this community has ever displayed that's been recorded.
Unlike many southern cities, Brunswick hasn't seen violence, riots, or major protests about race. In the 1960s, black and white leaders compromised. Schools integrated here before the rest of the state was forced to, Booker said.
I remember hearing the story of when the Klan had planned a march here, that they were met at the county line by a diverse group of well-armed men. That's what the story that I grew up hearing.
But beneath the surface, he said, racism was simmering. It was just happening quietly. The viral video of Arbery's killing has thrust it into view. Dante Hudson worked as a public defender in Glynn until 2012, at the time one of a handful of black attorneys in the community. He agrees this case has exposed racial tensions in Brunswick.
And I think some folks feel that, you know, this could be sort of the cathartic moment. You know, we've kind of been dealing with this for quite some time. No one has really said anything, but this is sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Hudson says Arbery's death reflects how relationships drive the criminal justice system in a small town like Brunswick. Local lawyers, he says, who knew judges and prosecutors, got better deals for their clients. Attorneys for Arbery's family allege this played a role in Arbery's case, too. Gregory McMichael, one of the men charged with Arbery's murder, is a former police officer and investigator in the local district attorney's office. He wasn't arrested for months. Now in Atlanta, Hudson says he enjoyed living in Brunswick, but working in the system was even more difficult for black lawyers.
For African Americans, it's really just a tough place to live and to work and to be successful. And it was a lot to sort of kind of break through that caste system. When I say the caste system legally, it was very helpful if you were white.
Today, there's just one practicing black lawyer based in Glynn, according to James Yancey, and it's him. He's been here for three decades.
I often tell some of my white brothers and sisters, I say, you know, I'm a lawyer, but we generally live in two different worlds. We may walk down the same street, but we live in different worlds.
Those worlds are now under scrutiny, pulling back the curtain on some of the daily indignities, Yancey says, black people in Glynn and across the country have to face. A 2017 video shows an interaction Arbery had with the police. He was sitting in his car in a park. Police suspect him of doing drugs and confront him. They ultimately try to tase him. Arbery accuses them of harassing him.
I got one day off a week. One day.
Okay.
One day off a week. I'm trying to chill on my day off, bro. I'm up early in the morning trying to chill.
Arbery's let go. Today, there are no black prosecutors in Glynn County's district attorney's office, no sitting black judges, and the county police department has been criticized for its lack of diversity. The Arbery shooting has prompted a wave of political activism and calls for new candidates in local elections like district attorney, which has been unopposed for decades.
We're guilty too.
John Perry again with the Brunswick NAACP at the podium in front of the courthouse.
We will not be on trial for the bullet shot, but we are on trial for every moment we heard of corruption. But since it did not affect us, we turned our head to it.
With all this new tension, County Commissioner Alan Booker still has hope for his hometown.
There's enough good people that are committed to change, real change, to make that happen. But we do need the world to keep the pressure and the spotlight on us because we do have a lot to clean up.
Now they have an opportunity, he said, to make life for everybody as equal as possible. In the meantime, state investigators and the U.S. Justice Department are continuing to look into the case. For NPR News, I'm Emma Hurt in Brunswick, Georgia.
Yeah. You're still saying there's no profiling, but it is. It is. We're being hunted every day. It's a silent war against African-American people as a whole.
The hunt is on. And you're the prey.
He pinned George Floyd to the ground with his knee. He ignored Floyd's pleas that he couldn't breathe. And now he has been charged with third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter in Floyd's death. Derek Chauvin is the now-fired Minneapolis police officer in question. Chauvin is white. Floyd was black. Protesters have been demanding this arrest for days in a city that's now burning, both figuratively and literally. But activists say they want more, and now a curfew has been ordered for the city starting at 8 p.m. tonight. NPR's Layla Fadel joins us now from Minneapolis. Hey, Layla.
Hi.
Hi. So what else do we know so far about this arrest?
Well, as you mentioned, this is that police officer in the video with his knee to George Floyd's neck as Floyd calls out for his mother and pleads for his life. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman made the announcement. This arrest and these charges are something demonstrators have been begging for, wondering why Chauvin wasn't under arrest already based on the video. If convicted on both of these charges, Chauvin could face up to 35 years in prison. The other three fired police officers who were involved are also under investigation. Freeman says he anticipates charges there.
But one of the big questions here is why the delay with this arrest? Floyd died Monday. It's now Friday. What's happened?
Yeah, you know, that's something that Freeman was asked. A lot of people are asking, what is the delay, including actually the mayor of this city, Minneapolis. This is what Freeman says about that.
We have charged this case as quickly as sufficient admissible evidence to charge it has been investigated and presented to us.
Included in that evidence is footage from bystanders, the officers' body cams, statements from witnesses, and the medical examiner's report. Freeman says his office charged Chauvin in record time. He also says he doesn't want to get it wrong and have people walk away because of a botched case.
But do you have any sense right now about whether this arrest will satisfy all those people out there protesting still?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know that it will. First of all, a lot of questions about why not a higher degree of murder and manslaughter charges when this video is so graphic and it clearly shows this man losing his life. They also say this is not just about George Floyd. It's about Floyd. It's about Breonna Taylor shot in her home in Kentucky. It's about the many other black people who deal with police abuse and racism, whose lives demonstrators say are put at risk when police are involved, and about a systemic problem that just is never solved. In a press conference today, Leslie Redman, the president of the NAACP Minneapolis chapter, said they want all four officers arrested and eventually convicted. And she says this was a long time coming.
If you keep murdering black people, the city will burn. We have stopped the city from burning numerous times, and we are not responsible for it burning now.
That's right.
Mike Freeman is holding up progress. Poverty and oppression is holding up progress. This is not simply looting. This is an uprising. An uprising of the oppressed people.
That's right.
So she says these protests, as you heard, are an uprising. She says officials are demonizing the protesters and focusing on the looting rather than looking at what led to the rage.
Now, I understand that you've been out near the third precinct this morning. This is the police precinct that had burned last night. Can you just tell us what was it like out there?
Well, the smoke was still rising, flames still coming out of businesses, and mixed emotions. A young mother, Somali-American, who wondered where she would safely shop in a pandemic now, and others saying this was the police's fault, including Riley Hansen, a pregnant software engineer.
Cops are killing black people in America, and, you know, this is what happens when we reach a certain level of rage, you know, because we're tired of dying.
That is NPR's Layla Fadel in Minneapolis. Thank you, Layla.
Thank you.
So I was saying, you know, no rioting, no looting. And so when people look at individual black people or collective, they see the highest level of dignity and self-respect. And when self-respect reaches the highest possible level, people will defend themselves. But just rioting and... Do you see where people really don't have weapons to go up against tanks?
Thousands of people in the streets, a police precinct set on fire, more anger and pain in Minneapolis over the death of George Floyd. But not just in that city. There were also protests in several other places, including New York. And in Louisville, Kentucky, at least seven people were shot. Hundreds packed downtown Louisville, demanding justice for another life lost at the hands of police. Breonna Taylor. Taylor is the black woman who was shot by police back in March, police conducting a raid on her residence. Joining us now from Louisville, reporter Amina Alahi of member station WFPL. Amina, thanks for being with us. You were out in those protests last night. What did you see?
We heard and saw a lot of amazing images and sounds. People gathered at first peacefully, demanding justice, demanding accountability for the police officers who took Breonna Taylor's life. In addition, we saw people there with young children who wanted them to see why it's important to be aware of the risks of being African American in America. And we also saw some people who were causing trouble. You know, as you mentioned, seven people were shot. The police tell us that they were all civilians and that no police officers fired their weapons last night. The latest update we got from the mayor of Louisville, Greg Fisher, is that five of the seven people are in good condition and two of them have been sent to surgery, although we haven't gotten any more information on them yet this morning.
Can you remind us about the circumstances of Breonna Taylor's death?
Yes, police officers entered Breonna Taylor's apartment after midnight on March 13th as part of a drug investigation. Breonna Taylor was not the main target of that investigation, but she had previously had a relationship with the person who was. The police say that they knocked and loudly announced themselves and gave her time to come to the door, but perhaps because it was late and she had been asleep, she wasn't able to make it to the door in the time that they were hoping, so they broke it down. By then, she and her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, who was there with her that night, were scared. And Kenneth Walker says that he fired a warning shot at the police because he thought some intruder was breaking in. The police fired back more than 20 shots, and eight of them struck Breonna Taylor and killed her.
So this, as we've noted, happened back in March. Protesters are still on the streets. Clearly, they feel like justice hasn't been served. Where does the case stand?
The investigation into the case is still ongoing with the police. They have turned some results over to the state's attorney general, who will be reviewing it, as well as to the FBI. But we learned from the FBI last week that they will be conducting their own investigation. You've also heard people on the national scale, such as Senator Kamala Harris, call for the Department of Justice to investigate. But so far, the public is still waiting to get the results of the police's internal investigation and to see what the FBI turns up.
I mean, how have officials responded to all this? Has the police department made any changes?
There have been some changes that have mainly come down from the mayor's office. He has instituted some greater controls on no-knock warrants, such as requiring that they be signed off on by the chief of police before they're taken to a judge for approval. Also attempting to expand when and how body cameras are used. And now the city is looking into creating a civilian oversight board. There are a lot of questions about how much control that civilian review board might have. For example, whether it might have subpoena power. And they're actually having their first extra work group meeting today to figure out what the structure of that might be. But in terms of the major reforms or concerns that the public is asking for, we haven't seen much of that yet, nor have any officials been willing to say that the arrest and firing of the officers involved in the shooting is the step that we can anticipate.
All right, we'll see if protests continue into the weekend. WFPL's Amina Alahi in Louisville. Thank you.
Thank you.
When they had that riot here in 1968, and those black people, a few black people were talking about going across Key Bridge into where the white people were. Mm-hmm. Hey, they knew better. Because the first thing you see when you went across Key Bridge at that time was guns and ammunition stores.
Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. When you go across, make that curve off of M Street and start across Key Bridge, I mean, the first thing you see in the distance is on the other side. I mean, the pawn shops, you know, ammunition, all kinds, guns. Ralph Jones guns. All that type of thing, you know. Army carbine surplus. And the guy who I work with, a white guy, said, man, I mean, he was just bold, flat out with it. He said, we were just wishing that we'd come across that bridge.
Oh, my gosh.
Said, man, we had pickup trucks full of ammunition and whatnot like you wouldn't believe.
He told the guy, the white guy just told you this?
Yeah, the white guy told me that. Said, guys, it's all up in the trees, man, with binoculars and whatnot.
Good gosh, man.
See, we're just wishing, you know, they got real wild and think they're going to leave the ghetto and come over there across that bridge into Arlington County. And, you know, there would have been a slaughter. It never got halfway across that bridge.
Hmm.
I mean, every white guy that had a rifle, man, I never got a chance to try out my new rifle with it. Man, I got a scope and everything, you know.
Protests continued in cities across the country after the death of an unarmed black man while in police custody in Minneapolis. After unrest overnight, more officials are imposing curfews from Louisville, Kentucky to Denver, Colorado. NPR's Leila Fadel joins us now from Minneapolis. Leila, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tell us what's happening today after events across the country overnight.
Well, we're seeing protests in dozens of cities from New York to Los Angeles, and people are out with the same message that they want real change to a police system that they say does not treat everyone equally. Here in Minneapolis, there were people out in droves with brooms and buckets trying to clean up their communities, getting donations to rebuild as buildings smoldered. People sifted through the rubble of their businesses. And some believe what Governor Tim Walz said today, which is that he thinks outside agitators are sowing chaos and destroying local community-owned businesses and landmarks. But it's really unclear what's happening overnight. Walz is referencing unconfirmed suspicions that maybe white supremacists or drug cartels are involved from outside the state. Meanwhile, you have Attorney General William Barr claiming it's anarchists from the left. Unclear what evidence there is for any of these claims. I've spoken to protesters with these suspicions, but also protesters that are angry and desperate, and they don't feel protected by law enforcement.
But obviously, there is still a lot of anger over George Floyd, who, once again, an African-American man. There was a videotape of, or there was tape of a white officer holding his knee on his neck for many, many, now a former officer, of course, holding his knee on his neck for many, many minutes. So what are people saying about that today?
I was just at a protest on the south side of Minneapolis where they were chanting, arrest all four. They don't want just that one former officer, Derek Chauvin, who was in that video, arrested. They want all four former officers arrested and convicted. And they don't want the focus of this moment to be on looting and fires, but on injustice that has gone on for generations. I spoke to Keisha Mitchell, and she has diabetes, which puts her at more risk of getting really sick with COVID-19. But she was out, and this is what she said.
I made the choice to give up my life knowing that this is so important. People are being harassed, we're dying, And we're afraid to be in our own communities. People with college educations, I have a degree. And when I am stopped, I am afraid. Never done anything wrong to anyone.
You almost forget that there is a pandemic going on here. And it's a pandemic that has hit Black communities hardest. And so they're taking huge risks.
Well, Governor Tim Walz said that he's fully mobilizing the National Guard. That's something that's never been done in the state's history. Could you just describe what is his tone today and that of other officials who are speaking?
You know, the tone is different today. Desperation, some anger. They want the burning of their cities to stop. A lot of this destruction is happening to Black-owned businesses, Indigenous-owned businesses, other businesses owned by people of color. Walz is saying that what happened last night was not about justice, but about chaos. And the two mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul echoing that sentiment. This is St. Paul's Mayor Melvin Carver saying everyone has the right to be angry.
Unfortunately, there are also those among us who would seek to use this moment, who would seek to use his death as an excuse, as a cover, to agitate for the destruction of those same communities that have been most traumatized by George Floyd's death.
That is reporting by NPR's Leila Fadel in Minneapolis. Leila, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I have lately had some concern about younger non-white Black students that attend historical Black colleges, even under times before a pandemic, the situation has always been problematic. Because, of course, because of the majority of, I would say, possibly employees, as well as I know for sure student enrollment, automatically the global system of race and white supremacy overall is going to negatively impact that environment. And with the pandemic going on, it makes it even more complicated.
The COVID-19 pandemic threatens the financial future of many universities, and historically Black colleges are among the most vulnerable. As Liz Schlemmer reports, Congress has responded with additional aid for HBCUs.
Maria Lumpkin was drawn to St. Augustine's University years ago. She remembers driving through campus in Raleigh as a prospective student and seeing the historic stone chapel built by students in 1895.
I fell in love with the campus, and I fell in love with the spirit of the people that were there.
Now she fosters that spirit of community as her alma mater's newest president. She looks forward to her students' return to campus in August.
I can't hug them, but I can do some elbow knocks with them, but I can't wait until my students get back.
Lumpkin became interim president of St. Augustine's in March, just as the gravity of the pandemic was taking hold.
These past few months presented lots of challenges unlike any we've seen.
Rodriguez Murray is a lobbyist with the United Negro College Fund, an organization that represents private HBCUs, including St. Augustine's. He jumped into emergency mode on March 12th.
The president of one of our colleges and universities called me at 9 o'clock that evening and said that if they don't get help because of the conditions of this pandemic, that college expects to be in the hole between $2 and $4 million this year.
As a group, HBCUs are up against many financial challenges. They've been historically underfunded. Generations of wealth inequality for Black Americans have left HBCUs with smaller endowments. They serve a high percentage of low-income students, and the private colleges generally rely more on tuition revenue. For some HBCUs, the cost of the pandemic could threaten their survival.
We've been through the Great Depression. We've been through Jim Crow and segregation. The institutions have no desire to fold now.
Three HBCUs have closed since the last recession. Others, including St. Augustine's and Bennett College in North Carolina, have risked losing their accreditation due to finances. With high stakes in mind, Murray joined forces with North Carolina Congresswoman Alma Adams.
One of the things that I pledged to do when I came to Congress was to continue to support the schools that supported me.
Adams is herself a first-generation graduate of North Carolina A&T State University and a former faculty member at Bennett College. North Carolina's HBCUs graduate more students than those of any other state, and Adams counts these students among her constituents. She and others pushed Congress to help HBCUs, and they responded with an unprecedented level of aid, about $1.4 billion.
I mean, and I still worry because this certainly has been a big boost for our schools. But it's not all that they need.
Still, Murray says this is more than HBCUs have received in past crises.
We have a history of getting targeted resources to the schools. Never this big and never this fast.
This is huge for us.
Lumpkin says the CARES Act assistance to St. Augustine's University was more than doubled thanks to the additional aid for HBCUs.
Without that funding, we would certainly not have the resources to be able to support the shift.
St. Augustine's will spend most of that on technology, and they're not alone. Peggy Valentine is the interim chancellor of Fayetteville State University. She recalled a student who was sharing one laptop with her four school-aged children.
These are challenges that many of our students, especially African-American students from low-income communities, face on a daily basis, having to make do with limited resources.
Without the extra aid, the university might have had to dig into operational funds to meet its students' needs. That could lead to layoffs, which Valentine hopes to avoid.
If we continue to receive the amount of appropriations from the states we have in the past few years, then we will be okay.
State taxes are projected to take a huge hit this year, but the legislature has historically funded the UNC system at levels above other southern states. Without that safety net, private colleges will have a harder time. President Lumpkin says so far fall enrollment looks good, but she doesn't know yet how much the pandemic will cost her university.
I will say this, we will spend all the money that we have and more.
Liz Schlemmer, North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.
I Can't Breathe, Part 2. The furious struggle for justice by the late Eric Garner took years, long, hard years, by his family and friends before a bare pittance was granted in the belated decision to dismiss the cop who choked him to death, uncharged, I might add. The name Eric Garner has become a catchword for the state of Black America for decades, if not centuries, who can barely breathe free air. The phone cam recording of the police killing of George Floyd in the streets of Minneapolis, Minnesota, by a beefy cop putting his knee on the neck of Floyd provides an eerie echo of Garner's words from at least 5 years before. I can't breathe. Floyd, his breath cut off, cries for the person who gave him life, his mama. Within minutes, Floyd is gone. Eric Garner was approached by a police squad after a merchant complained that he was selling Lucy's or single cigarettes. Floyd was approached by several cops after a merchant claimed he passed a forged $20 bill. Think about that. Two men, two fathers, choked to death because of merchant complaints about loose cigarettes and a fake $20 bill, allegedly. This is a statement about how, in a capitalist society, merchandise is more important than Black life. George Floyd joined a collective he never wanted to join, and perhaps never expected to join. It is the roll call of the dead, caused by the state and a system of repression that is all pervasive. Does Black life matter? Not yet. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jamal.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, May 30, 2020, so I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, suggestions to offer. The number to dial, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Lots to get to. I was working on getting the audio together for the broadcast for this evening. I was disrupted. I heard a noise from my phone I did not recognize. I looked at the device, got an alert, I guess citywide, from the mayor that they were imposing a 5 p.m. curfew in Seattle, and that they were ordering everyone to vacate the downtown area. And I'm about, like a 10-minute drive, 15-minute drive, depending on traffic, 10, 15 minutes from downtown. And they were ordering everyone to disperse. And I looked at the news, and they had, like, police cars on fire, and they had, it looked like, armed individuals who would be classified as white, some with assault rifles, some with pistols. Total chaos. And I mean, it's like pouring rain. It is not a pretty almost summer day here at all. It feels like autumn. I'm not even sure if it's above 60 degrees. It's been raining all day long, and they've been doing this out in the rain all day long. I'm thankful that I was not headed downtown for any other miscellaneous reasons, and just happened to stumble into all of that. White people in Seattle, incidentally, they love to run around in the streets. Like, what do they say? At the drop of a hat? Oh, yeah, anything. The turtles? Let's protest for the turtles. The niggers? Let's protest for the niggers. Climate change? Let's protest for climate change. Vaccine? Let's protest for quarantine? Anything. Anything. You name it, we are in the streets. We got the markers ready to roll. Woo! Just needed an excuse. They had Macklemore. I don't know if folks remember that. We talked about that back in when they did all this the last time in 2014. I believe Macklemore was out in the streets with them. They were throwing eggs at the police cars that time around. This was in, to be specific, I believe this was 2014 in November when they announced that they were not going to do any charges against the white killer of Michael Brown Jr. That was when they went in. Yeah, let's throw the eggs at the cars. Yeah, we're not going to take it. Not in our name. Woo! Seattle. Still, best plantation in the known universe, or at least in this hemisphere. So they were talking about all the information in the different news reports, what's happening. And I thought of James Brown. Oh, they were talking about Georgia. That's what it is. They were talking about the longstanding problems in Georgia. And I remembered that James Brown, victim of white supremacy, that's a cowbell too, unfortunately, that he has an autobiography, The Godfather of Soul. And in his autobiography, he also talks about, man, Georgia is not a cool place to be. So I finally went and I tracked down his autobiography, which looks like it is astronomically better than the abomination that we are currently reading in the book club, but we're almost done with that, thankfully. Woo! James Brown might be a nutritional Uncle Tom. I don't even know. Anyway, so this is from James Brown's autobiography, The Godfather of Soul, Chapter 31, Home Fires. He writes, one day my real estate man in Augusta, Georgia, showed Dee Dee and me the kind of house we'd been looking for. It was on Walton Way, one of the best streets in the wealthier part of town then. It was in a white section of town, but that was all right with me. I wasn't prejudiced, cowbell. It had enough room and enough yard that we could have some privacy and peace and quiet. When I came off the road, which is what Dee Dee wanted, it didn't matter to me who the neighbors were, and it shouldn't have mattered to them. I told the agent I'd take it. When word got out that I was going to buy there, some of the people in the area became very disturbed. They did not want a man of my origin to buy a home on Walton Way. I once had millions of dollars transferred from a New York bank to an Augusta bank in a single day, but they didn't want me living where I wanted to. They got up a campaign to keep me out, but I refused to be intimidated. They approached the real estate agent and tried to stop him from closing the deal. He told them that if he didn't sell me that house, he was going to turn around and sell me some other house nearby, so they might just as well get used to it. I bought it and gave my old house to my father. After I moved in on Walton Way, some of the people approached me to try and buy me out, offering me twice what the house was worth. That happens in Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun. Another cowbell. After I lived there for a while, it all died down and everybody forgot about it. But the results of that kind of thinking were fixing to break out real bad in Augusta, Georgia. There was a lot of frustration, a lot of anger waiting to be touched off. You could feel it. I grew up on those streets, and I knew. When the spark came, I was doing a gig in Flint, Michigan. I think we just heard about not having good clean water. I received a phone call at my hotel at about 6 o'clock on a Monday evening from Governor Lester Maddox. He told me there was a riot going on in Augusta. The city was in flames. There was looting, vandalism, and sniper fire. The local authorities had lost control of the situation, and he was sending in the National Guard and the Highway Patrol. He said the sheriff advised him to call me and see if I would come home and use my radio station and my personal influence to do what I could to stop it. I promised to meet him in Augusta in the morning to discuss the situation. The whole thing had started a few days before when a 16-year-old black kid was beaten to death in Richmond County Jail, the same jail I turned 16 in. He talks about that in the book. A lot of people in the black community claimed he'd been beaten by the guards. The sheriff said his two cellmates did it, beating him with a shoe and belt and banging his head on the wall. Some of the black people said that even if that was so, it was the authorities' fault for not supervising the prisoners enough. There had been peaceful protest on Saturday in front of the jail. On Monday, there was a march through downtown. Everything was fine until the march reached the municipal building. That's when a student from Payne College hauled down the Georgia state flag and burned it. It was the Confederate flag at that time. I think some people tried to move in, some rocks got thrown, and things got out of hand from there. Windows were broken, looting started, and some gunshots went off. Fire started. The Augusta police force and the sheriff's deputies started sealing off the Terry, all 130 blocks of it. At first, the looting was mostly around 9th and Gwinnett, but it spread to Broad Street and all over downtown. During the night, there were fires all over the area, and they spread, too, because the firemen ran into sniper fire. Eventually, the guards showed up with live ammunition and bayonets. They rolled in with jeeps, half-ton trucks, and armored personnel carriers with machine guns mounted on them. They set up blockades and searched cars and tried to contain things. I flew in on the Learjet early in the morning with Bird. From the air, I could see flames and clouds of smoke. It looked like some of the scenes I had seen from the helicopter in Vietnam. I went to my father's house to get ready to meet with the sheriff to find out what was going on. I was getting into a car when the police pulled up and said they'd take me in their car. I said, no, that'll just make people madder. I don't want any police cars near me. I know the way to the jail. Nobody'll bother me. The street around the jail was lined with guardsmen. I went inside to talk to the city officials. They assured me the boy had been beaten to death by his cellmates. I told them I didn't want to choose sides in the thing. I just didn't want to see any more bloodshed. When we came out of the building, television cameras were waiting, and I made an appeal to all Augustans. Don't save face, save your city. I said, we can't be bullheaded. We all have to deal as one, to do unto others as you would do unto them. Free from the jail, I went to my radio station offices out on Eisenhower Drive to meet with Governor Maddox. It was a cordial, businesslike meeting, no grandstanding or threats or arguments on either side. The sheriff and the community commission chairman briefed us on the latest developments. Then the governor told me what he intended to do. I was advised by my intelligence people that this was going to happen, he said. Now that it has, I'm bringing in the necessary personnel to protect lives and property. It doesn't make any difference to me whether the rioters are Republicans or Democrats, black or white. My purpose is to preserve the peace, and that's what I'm going to do. I understand that, I said, but we need your help. I can't communicate with the black community on this, but you can. If you would appeal to the people over your radio station to stop the burning and shooting, I think it could be a major contributing factor to restoring order. Governor, I said, I can't back up in supporting my people and their grievances. I'm sure you recognize that. Yes, sir, I do. But I don't want to see any more lives lost either, so I'll do better than appeal. I'll broadcast appeals around the clock. I'll go out in the streets. I'll talk to whoever needs talking to until this thing is over. And then he goes talking about him going immediately to broadcast and try to get people to calm down a bit, use some logic, not burn down. He says, in quotes, it doesn't make sense to burn up your own neighborhood. And he goes from there. But this is all in James Brown's autobiography, The Godfather of Soul. Fascinating how many times this has been repeated in the system of white supremacy. So many similarities. He could be talking about things that are happening right now. If anybody has been out and, you know, participating, observing in any of the protests or marches or what have you that's been going on, and you want to call in to give your observations of what happened, whether it was constructive, what you saw, feel free. I will only reiterate the same thing that I've been saying for years now. I don't think it's safe or constructive to participate in any of these events. Certainly you can do so if you choose. I don't have the ability to stop anyone and am not criticizing anyone who chooses to do so. But I think there's a lot of evidence at this point to make an observation about what's likely to happen at these events and the efficacy, meaning what's going to happen. So we get, you know, maybe we get 10,000 people, you know, maybe we get 20,000 people. We go out and we march and we get signs and do whatever. We do all of this. So is someone going to be arrested? Is someone going to be convicted? Is someone going to get fired? Is the police department going to be disbanded? What's going to be the result? Like, there's a lot of history where we can look and see what is the likely outcome of this protest going to be, to make a logical decision about whether or not this is something that we should attempt again. I think that's logical at this point. The thing that I would say about this, the same thing I think I said yesterday, with these events, just in the past 48 hours, I've seen reports where it was alleged that there might have been an off-duty enforcement officer in Minneapolis who was participating in criminal activity, breaking windows and looting and the like. There were reports of protesters being struck by a vehicle, which I had seen a number of times before, as well as with the first incident, in terms of there being allegations, sometimes substantiated, that there were enforcement officials involved in some of the criminal antics. There were reports of shots fired. We heard some of those. I had to read about, I didn't just do like what they call a double take. I had to look about five or six times, like that said seven shots fired. After about the fifth or sixth time I looked, I said, oh, wait a minute. It does not say seven shots fired. It says seven people shot. That was just in Louisville, Kentucky, at the protests for Breonna Taylor and Mr. George Floyd. And I just, wow. If you are going to be engaged in these events, you should be prepared for anything to happen. And I mean anything. If they should have, you know, a spacecraft that should shoot out of the sky and begin macing everyone, you know, and then beam you up into, you know, quarantine jail on the spaceship, you should not be surprised. Like, oh, I knew they were going to have all kinds of new riot technology. So, yep, I expected the quarantine spaceship. Anything. Shot and killed, maimed, tank, anything. Because you just don't know. Anything can happen. It's so many people. It's so much chaos. And the people who train. The other thing I think it's important to keep in mind, race soldiers, there's a lot of evidence because these type of things happen. You do have one segment of the population. They train for riots. Generally, it's been my observation that the people that go out and participate in marches and protests and those type of things, most of the time, they do not train in advance, like for all scenarios, so that they know what to do. Generally, that is not the case. Enforcement officers, the National Guard, these folks generally have operations where they get to go and practice. Now, get your nigger knocker and your shield, and this is what you do. Ask Norm Stamper. Big guest on the Cows many times. They train with the nigger knocker. Look forward to using the nigger knocker. Oh, and the boogaloo. I forgot. James Brown does talk a lot about racism. They're trying to get him out of the neighborhood. I guess they might have burned his house down. I don't know. He talks about rioting and looting. He does talk about the boogaloo. He is not talking about what white people are talking about when they talk about the boogaloo. They have been using that term a lot this week. We were right on schedule talking about that last week, Dr. Peter Simi. You got a lot of race soldiers, newly armed, looking forward. This is the boogaloo. We got them there out in the street. Look at them. I'm ready. I got my snipe. You heard Mr. Fuller. That is the general ethos of racist man, racist woman. It's many, many reasons why I recommend not participating in these events. But that's something to keep in mind as well. Why, hey, I'm ready to die. I'm going out to protest. I'm ready to die. Anything happens, arrest, whatever. I'm ready, and it's worth it. Fine. But keep that in mind. You got a lot of racists. This is the boogaloo. They have been waiting for this. I've been polishing and cleaning my gun. I just bought a new round of ammunition. I'm so excited. Yes, thank you, George Floyd. Yes. Context of white supremacy. For mental health, which I think is primary this week, man, it has been so engulfing. Like I said, I got the emergency text. I wasn't, you know, looking at protest footage and, you know, trying to be a part of any of that. I was trying to prepare for the broadcast, and I got the alert on my phone. I think for mental health, I would really avoid binging on all of the protest footage. I think so many people in the world, we had B from Toronto called in who was saying the same thing. We had the footage. They have protests in Toronto that have nothing to do with George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, or Breonna Taylor. They got their own victims worldwide. Saying that to say mental health, I think there are lots of folks who were struggling with mental health even before we got to all of these incidents of the shootings and the footage and all of that because of the virus and just white supremacy in general. I would encourage either turning the television off, stepping away from the screen, putting your phone down. You do not need to watch, you know, every incident. If you get information, if things are happening in your city and you need to be aware, if you're, oh man, I'm going to downtown Seattle, I'm supposed to go there. For obviously, you need that information to stay safe. Get the information that you need to stay safe. But I just don't see a reason to just binge on footage, and then they splice in footage of, you know, different angles, and then we got new footage of how Mr. Floyd expired, and then we got extra footage. We got another time when Ahmaud Arbery, he was almost hazed to death, and just to go over this glorification of black death, I just don't think that it's healthy. There was already a lot of that happening with COVID-19. We can be informed about these events. They are important acts of white supremacy, shouldn't diminish the victims. But in a system of white supremacy, you will be exhausted if you are looking for every time a black person is killed, either by enforcement officials or virus or medical apartheid or Kuhn Man doctors or whatever. I mean, it's so many things in terms of ways that white supremacy operates, it will just exhaust you emotionally, physically. You just won't even have the vitality to function. So I encourage, turn off the television. Don't binge on this content. If you are around family members, be mindful and make sure they are not binging on this content. And the same thing I said, I would not encourage participating in these events. White supremacy racism happens every day. If we protested every time a black person was killed, we would not get anything done. We would just constantly be protesting. Let's see. James Brown, the Boogaloo. Other things as we proceed. Seeing as how stressful all of this has been, we will see if things are stable enough to proceed with our August 5th through August 9th counter-racist yoga retreat, Washington, D.C. Hopefully, by then, things will be substantially calmer with the virus and the unrest. And maybe this will be our first time being able to come out and just relax, have some great food, get some yoga in, get some meditation in. Desperately needed in these times. August 5 through the 9, the deadline has been pushed to June 21 just to allow things to stabilize, make sure that we can proceed. Drop an email with details, untiljustice@gmail.com, if you need info. But Washington, D.C., August 5th through the 9th. Yoga, plant-based meals, counter-racism workshops. Hopefully we'll be able to get out and have fun for the summer, later summer. Let's see. Few things from the sound clips or news reports, rather. They mentioned Brazil, now the second most cases of COVID-19 in the world. And they've still been killing black people, black women of Brazil, Marquis Treve. He was writing both about their explosion in COVID-19 cases and black people being killed by enforcement officials. That's, you know, typical in Brazil. They do that even more frequently in Brazil, that's the type of thing that I'm talking about, than they do here in terms of enforcement officers killing black people. They do it by the bushel there, literally. But the segment that we heard on Brazil, when they talked about who was being impacted, they didn't just say, oh yeah, it's the black people, the Negros down here. Oh yeah, they are catching it hard. They said, oh, it's the people in the favelas, in close quarters, yeah, who don't have resources. Like, the black people? That's who you're talking about? Like, not being specific. Very, very common. Next, they had the report on Chicago. They're opening the fire hydrant to get water to wash their hands. Now, I hear that type of report. Number one, the first thing we do is evaluate, now, is that true? You know, do I think they're making something up, lying to us on Chicago public radio? Because that does happen a lot in the system of racism. No, I tend to think that's probably accurate, especially after reading Packing Them In. Oh, yeah. Dr. Sylvia Hood Washington. Oh, yeah. I think that's probably accurate. System of racism. So when I hear a report like that, until I hear any evidence that it's false, it's kind of challenging for me to think black people in Chicago or anywhere in the system of racism wouldn't be more susceptible to any sort of virus, COVID-19 or anything else. They're opening, and he was in his 60s. This isn't a young person. At-risk population, they say. And you're having to open a fire hydrant to wash your dishes, presumably to take a bath, to flush the toilet. Wow. In Chicago. Wow. The system of white supremacy. Water. In 2020, water. They got Elon Musk and they're talking about their space launch. We're doing our hide out off the planet. And we're having to crack open the fire hydrant just so we can flush the toilet. Wow. Packing them in, indeed. Let's see. And the Chicago, I totally forgot that. I remember that from 2017 when they were talking about the Chicago Water Department. I'm surprised that's not a ticket because, they generally do ticket you, right? Even Spike Lee had that in Do the Right Thing. They don't just let you go out willy-nilly and crack the fire hydrant whenever you need a sip of water or need to flush your toilet. But the Chicago Water Department, I remember that when they got the reports that they were like swapping racist jokes and all the rest of it at the Chicago Water Department. And again, that's the same type of thing, you know, that I would think. Now, when I hear that, if that's true, no reason to think it's not. Why would I think black people would be healthy and not susceptible to an illness of some sort? Can't even get water. Basics of sanitation and hygiene, I think. Next, man, oh man. White women do it better. The ignorant white woman, the confrontation at New York Central Park, pause for the Central Park Five, raping black males. Amy Cooper, white woman is at the park with her Cocker Spaniel. She looks at that black male, also Mr. Cooper. She looks at him and she says, I will call the police and tell them that an African American is harassing me. Now, does that sound like a white person who is ignorant about racism? That sounds like that white woman, Miss Cooper, is making it like explicit. I'm not just going to call the police. I'm going to call the police and let them know that a Negro is doing something incorrect. That's another great illustration of where all of the different titles really don't mean anything. Like in that context, you could easily swap Afro-American, African-American, African, Nubian, Pan-African, ADOS, colored, person of colored, Negro, nigger. It really doesn't matter. They all are about the same. Nigger just makes it, you know, now's no confusion. We got it, no confusion. Be preferable. I'm going to call the enforcement officers and let them know there's a nigger harassing me. You could be a hashtag in 30 seconds. Like, you already know. You know, and I know what that means. I'm not just going to say somebody is harassing me. I'm not just going to say that I'm being bothered. I'm going to say an African American. I almost don't even need to finish the sentence. You could be dead in 30 seconds. Central Park Five, you could be dead in 30 seconds. Not ignorant about white supremacy, racism. And did you hear in a segment they had the audacity? Said, oh, yes, it's a shame, you know, Miss Cooper, what she did, called the police on him and all that. And she's not even obeying the rules. And she snatched her dog and she's given up the Cocker Spaniel. They've reported abusing the dog. How are you going to be out in the park abusing Negroes and abusing the Cocker Spaniel? Like, man, really? We got to stop and talk about because she snatched the Woo! System of race. I will never own a dog. Never. Next. The metaphors, I generally request, if we could not use metaphors for this program exclusively, they dropped some nice ones. So we had, they were talking about Ahmaud Arbery, and they said, racism, oh, it's just beneath the surface. It's been simmering. I hear that one a lot. I cook frequently, right? Like what did I cook this week? I made cheeseless macaroni and cheese. I made falafel. I made tahini. I made apple cobbler. Cheeseless nacho cheese that was extraordinary. Lots of smoothies. I cooked a lot of stuff this week. I cooked pasta. I cook frequently. I let many things simmer. I have no idea what racism, white supremacy, simmering being. What does that mean exactly? Because people use that one a lot. Oh, it's simmering. It's just beneath the surface. No idea. What's one of the other ones we got? Two different worlds. That's what they, we live in two different worlds. What does that mean exactly? Are you saying that white people live on Earth and the non-white people live someplace? Like, what exactly are you saying? Lots of confusion. Be direct about what we're saying. Racists, a lot of times they'll use these type of metaphor. Oh, yeah, it's beneath the surface. Mm-hmm. It's been simmering. Mm-hmm. Just like a good chili. Mm-hmm. they'll use these type of metaphors because it's not distinct. It doesn't provide clarity so that you understand the problem. White people, racist man, racist woman, racist child. The very folks that are out protesting in some of these instances. They do this. It is deception. Victims, myself included, we've been exposed to this misconduct for a long time. Frequently, we are still learning, and sometimes we just don't have logic to articulate our views, and so we'll substitute and employ a metaphor, analogy of some sort. For this broadcast, if we could be explicit, direct with what we want to say, that would be super appreciated. I will prompt about the metaphors. Much obliged. The number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be appreciated, just so we don't have to compete with a lot of unnecessary noise in the background. If you have a hand up, you can unmute, share your commentary, and then when you're done, you can mute your line. If you have additional commentary, just you can wait, let other folks speak, and then unmute and share again. If you could take about 5 minutes to share your commentary, that would be super appreciated also, just to make sure everybody gets at least one opportunity to speak. Again, if you have additional thoughts, you can use your five, let everyone else speak at least once, and then you can come back with your additional questions, suggestions. Right on. Hope folks are staying safe within all of this and preserving your mental health. Take some time, some quiet time. Might be a great time to do a little bit of reading. You don't have to read a bunch. Just generally, reading requires sitting down, getting kind of a relatively calm environment. Might be a good time to just do, you can do like 10 minutes of reading, 15 minutes of reading, just to get a little quiet, get some meditation time, do things to preserve, replenish your mental health. Wow, this has been a destabilizing and chaotic year. Hope folks are doing as best they can to take care of themselves. Let's see. Folks who dialed in, first two folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings. Our caller in South Carolina.
Yes. Greetings, guests, callers, and listeners. Just a couple of observations on the clips. First one regarding the racist in Central Park with the victim of racism and the dog. I noticed that the racist suspect reporter described the dog as struggling to breathe. And I think that she was deliberately practicing racism when she said that, because it was almost like she intertwined the situation with George Floyd and the other gentleman who got lynched the same way on camera, and equated that with the dog. And a field note, I'm in Columbia, South Carolina. I went out today to the market, and just as like you're in a loop when these terroristic things happen and and black people are the target, of course, white people begin their nonsense. You know, doing things that when they see you, I mean, you could be like, you know, we have the social distancing, but you could be 8 feet away and they're, excuse me, and oh, sorry. And, you know, they see you coming and jumping out of the way, you know, so I got a lot of that. I always notice that they're extra when these things happen. And,
I'm in Columbia, South Carolina, and usually I didn't expect anything to really, any protests or any major happenings to take place here, but I was wrong. There was a peaceful protest in downtown Columbia, and it went from the State House. There were some speakers. Then suddenly, you know, the press is always made aware by the organizers as to how these things are going down. So they went to the police station, and in front of the police station, things got violent. And there were some rocks and some bottles and whatever being thrown. And the next thing you know, a police car is on fire and windows are being busted out in downtown Columbia and the restaurants and tear gas and the whole nine. So there was a young man who was the organizer, and he spoke to a reporter, and he was very tearful because he said that there were white people there in Hawaiian shirts, and they were the ones who started the rock throwing and the bottles and setting the fires. He said that he recognized a lot of them because when he organized a peaceful protest for the Charleston Nine, he remembered them. And so these reports of these crisis actors and things of that nature being intertwined in and causing a lot of these things, a lot of these violent acts and these the property destruction with a lot of these protests are true. And just one last thing, this whole thing about breath, this COVID-19 is a disease that takes our breath away. We are watching men being lynched by them being suffocated. This whole thing about breathing and how it's affecting Black people. And I just believe that all of these things are in this grand plan to try to take us out. But that's all I had, Gus. And I found my mute button on my phone, and I'm going to use it. Thank you for letting me speak.
Still learning. We are still learning. I love it. The Charleston Nine, that's the victims of white terrorist Dylan Storm Roof back in 2015, which almost seems like ancient history. But yeah, it's, that's what I mean. You got to be prepared. When I say be prepared for everything, that means you got to be prepared for provocateurs, white provocateurs in Hawaiian shirts hurling rocks. You got to be prepared for that too. Like, oh yeah, I expected that they were going to be here breaking windows and hurling rocks. Yeah, they do that too. Anything can happen at these events. That's why I'd say, you know what? I'm going to sit at home and we'll think of something constructive to do. We can all be you, however you feel or whatever response we have, just trying to use logic to figure out the best way. These type of events, it's you just never know what's going to be there. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, suggestions, questions, to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Hey, what's up, Gus? Caller from New Jersey. And I didn't participate in the protest that was going on in New Jersey today. North New Jersey I would say one of those maybe 50% or more Black cities. So outside agitators, even though it's the largest city in New Jersey, it's, you know, it's still kind of like a large city, small town kind of feel, everybody knows everybody, meaning that so outside agitators would be quickly identified. They came out in large numbers. I watched it live on Facebook. A friend was streaming live. Immediately I asked him because I've seen the outside agitators that was coming in from Minneapolis and other cities. So I asked him, did he experience any of that there? He said, yeah. So he said that there were a few white agitators that climbed on a pole and set a flag on fire, but they was immediately you know, they was immediately surrounded, and the situation was diffused. It's just very interesting, even kind of like watching the anti-blackness from white people and black people when the situation first started, when the whole narrative was burning down your whole community. And I've seen nothing but, you know, white agitators, tearing, breaking windows and setting things ablaze. And, and I don't take this as me being saying anything disparaging about black people. I just don't think black people are running around with Molotov cocktails and are actually setting a lot of these establishments ablaze. There's a content creator that I follow who is a Minneapolis native to the Twin City area. And she said, yeah, you know, I mean, once the property was damaged, yes, you know, there were people who took advantage of taking things. But she said the majority of the people that was causing the most chaos were the people that was outside of the community. And even when you talk about the whole destroying your own community narrative, you got to understand Minneapolis, when I looked it up, is 63% white, 18% black. All right. So it's just real interesting. We see a lot of content creators on the internet. We see a lot of rappers, and, you know, a lot of them throughout the years have been constantly hyping black people up to take action, to stop being passive, to stop being cowardly. And when buildings are ablaze, when, you know, there's violence, violence is the response of what happened to George Floyd. You know, these same people now have changed the message, specifically in Atlanta, whether it's Killer Mike or T.I., and, you know, basically trying to calm the crowd down for tearing up Atlanta. But the you have to be responsible. You know, every time there's an incident, you know, these same people lend their voice and hype black people up to, find another way to protest, meaning, you know, that the traditional protest of marching isn't effective, and to, meet force with force. And then when this force is met and when cities are ablaze, when what you've been hyping people up to do, whether outside agitators or black people, when they do it, now you're on TV trying to calm the situation down. You can't have it both ways. You can't. And I was talking to somebody, there was a police officer that was in my inbox, and he says, tearing up your own community. I'm like, how hypocritical is that? You know, not to put it in a historical context, but the Civil War, by definition, was tearing down your own community on a large scale. So I am not for the violence. I'm not promoting it, because if I'm not going to be there on the front lines, I am not going to push people to be violent. But this cognitive dissonance, this lack of understanding, you know, for this reaction, like the person used the metaphor that you talked about, what did they say? It's racism is simmering. I guess that's a metaphor that means that it's bubbling over, and one day it's going to explode. I don't know if that's the meaning of that metaphor. But, everything that I'm seeing is, very interesting. you know, the news media and I'm just looking at, you know, white young men dressed in black with masks on, destroying police cars and breaking into banks. There was even a situation where I was saying they broke into a car dealership and drove the car out of the window. And the police has stood down. So if this isn't white supremacy on full display, and when I say white supremacy on full display, meaning that, you know, being white, your decadence, your behavior is justified. In some way, somehow, the news media has looked over this, and somehow the looters are black people. And from everything that I see, it's nothing. It's white people. It's young white people.
30 seconds.
Young white people. Okay, and I'm sorry to go on a rant. So that's all I got, Gus. Thanks for letting me share.
No apologies needed. Just making sure we nab all of our folks. Much obliged for our caller. Lots of hypocrisy within the system of racism, white supremacy. Lots of hypocrisy. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. If you have commentary to share, proceed.
Hello. May I be heard? Good. Thank you. I want to just make it quick because I'm kind of in a hurry, but I wanted to make a couple observations, and I hope everybody's having a good evening. I think this will be the last year, or at least the last round of so-called protests or property destruction, where artificial intelligence, robotic intelligence, is not implemented as a response by the white supremacists. I think this is going to be the argument here on. Going forward to reel in the technology that we've been talking about on this program, and, you know, myself and like Thomas and other people, I'm sure, have been learning about. So there's nothing really, in my opinion, constructive about, you know, what's going on right now, especially considering the white racist marauding, instead of trying to, as they say, aid and get a point across about racism through police brutality. I also believe, based on observations, the brief observation I made of the video, I feel that that gentleman was murdered. I think it was premeditated because of the body language of the officer and putting his hand in his pocket to apply the weight. It's almost like, I think, in other words, once he made the decision to do it, he committed to it, to knowing that it would end in death. So he should have a first degree murder charge. But, you know, it certainly wasn't, he just did it and it just so happened that he died. I think he knew he was committing the act for the purpose of ultimate racism. And there was one other thing. I can't think of it. I hope everybody's safe. But again, it's 2020. Going into 2021, get ready for the machinery, get ready for the robots. And that's all I have to say. Good night.
Much obliged. Irie in Louisiana, the male caller who spoke up simultaneously. Thanks for your patience, sir.
Yes, Gus, this is Jane Conversation. I wanted to give some observations and support some of the things that have been said thus far. Particularly with the last caller, it has been reported by Business Insider that Customs and Border Patrol have already flown Predator B drones over Minneapolis in the last few days. So I think her observation is correct, and that will be the case going forward. Also, I wanted to speak on the ways in which there's a sexual vulnerability that is happening simultaneously with these lynchings of these black males that we've seen throughout the news reports you broadcasted, you played the, you know, you reading off the title of Dr. Tommy Curry's The Man Not. And on page 156 of The Man Not, in his chapter, Eschatological Dilemmas, he speaks about this. But I think it's very significant in this point because there's a sexual vulnerability and a sexual fetishization of black male flesh that I think can be observed through both Christian Cooper and Gregory Floyd. There's reports right now through the white media discussing the extent to which Mr. Floyd participated in pornographic ventures on his own. And these things are being shown to add, I think, a homoerotic element and a sexual vulnerability to his lynching that I think a lot of us are taught to look over. As well with that, Christian Cooper, we had the police call on him in New York City. His sexuality was used in a counterintuitive kind of way. But nevertheless, it was weaponized after the event occurred, particularly on Twitter. There were white gay activists talking about because this man presented himself as homosexual, that he should be seen as a hero. And that he was, it was very counterintuitive because his being homosexual allowed him to be humanized by this faction of white activists as well. Also speaking to the white protesters, personally, me and my close family members of mine have observed this ourselves. There were protests over a young black man that was murdered by the St. Louis Police Department in 2016. His name was Anthony Smith. He wasn't even 25 years old. At the time, we went out. The protest happened two blocks from my grandmother's house. We go out there and there are white anarchists who are prepared. They have supplies. They have guns. There are right-wing groups out there antagonizing the police. And by the time the St. Louis Police Department rolled the tanks out, the only people who had to deal with the threat of that type of violence were the people who lived in the neighborhood for the next week and a half. So I think that is one aspect of these protests. But I also think it's being weaponized to blunt or stop the train of thought or the logic that we would engage in with programs like yours. So when we can call into the cows, we can engage in clear thinking and rational thought. We can talk about what we need to do as people suffering from white supremacy on a regular basis. But with the pictures and the narratives that emerge from the spectacle of these bombings and these burnings, a lot of these things are taken out of the common ground and not able to be spoken about in a substantive way, which is why I really agree with your diagnosis that these things need to be turned off, that these things don't need to be engaged with in any kind of substantive or rigorous way because they are manipulated heavily. Also, I listened to your report about Alabama and the cases increasing in Alabama. I thought it was significant that that section of Alabama and Alabama in general was observed by United Nations officials just in 2017. And they reported that they had never seen extreme poverty like that in any industrialized developed country in the world. And we know the racial composition of these counties in Alabama are overwhelmingly black people. So I think that goes with the story you shared about Brazil and the increasing cases there. And I think it's significant to pay attention to what happens in the international realm as far as how the president of Brazil responds to the administration in the United States, and how they conceptualize international relations between the two countries as a result of this. So I listened to that carefully, and I thought that was very interesting. But lastly, I wanted to just share that I think with this latest lynching, the fact that a lot of black people are using the existence of white people protesting with them as a claim to humanity, as a claim to legitimacy, I think it says a lot about the ways in which black complaints about racism are generally just discounted and not seen as legitimate. And I think the response has been very interesting to watch, to see that once white people, they validate this sense of wrongness and this lynching, now it's a legitimate protest. Now it should be put up on international stages. And I was listening to that report about the county in Georgia where Ahmaud Arbery was lynched as well. And they were talking about white and black people working together to stop KKK rallies in the 1960s. Yet racism is still embedded in, a part of the everyday life of that county and a part of how it runs, no doubt. So I think it's very interesting to see how spectacle works in that case as well. But I think it comes with a particular kind of arrangement of epistemology where black people just don't have a legitimate claim to being victims of anything, just in the popular imagination of the country. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Much obliged. I think we've seen that a few times before, where just the presence of white people at some of these protests can change the way that they're talked about or thought about, even for a lot of victims of racism, just having white people there. It's like, oh, we've been validated or heard or something of that nature. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have hands up. Again, if we have any folks, if you did participate in any of these events, if you, have any observations from your time there, feel free to share. Hope you were safe if you have been out participating, not being too close. Wash your hands once you get back. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all of the listeners and participants. Yes, I've just been making some televised observations and some thought in itself. The first thing I would like to do is, because the word reveler has been on my mind and I've been using it in communicating with a few people on the subject that everybody is talking about right now. And according to the dictionary, a reveler is a person who is enjoying themselves in a lively, noisy way. And that's primarily what I see by the non-black or white participants who are not in law enforcement in this particular occasion, for the most part. Even the people who are quote unquote going into shopping district and breaking the windows and that sort of thing. It's fun. The revelry is fun to a lot of people and enjoyment, and who are willing to take the risk of, well, maybe I may get shot with a rubber bullet or a have to suffer from some tear gas. I got my soap and whatever I need to do in order to vanquish that discomfort and go right back to what I was doing within an hour or so, or maybe the next day. Basically what that does, that diverts the attention of examples of, or in general, the global system of racism, white supremacy, where I think people should have, especially non-white people, should have their attention towards. The as far as law enforcement is concerned. They are not armed primarily. The only fatal potential armament that they are carrying everywhere is their service revolver. It's not revolver, but service weapons, and they have that on a daily basis anyway. They primarily are using non-fatal devices, although, you know, you can get hurt by some of that. In some cases, you know, with preconditioned ailments, a person can probably be fatal, but it's a low percentage. That white official, law enforcement official, is not going to kill his niece, his rebellious niece. And in turn, that white person, even the reveler, did not come out to that event with the idea in mind of shooting to death someone in law enforcement, a white person in law enforcement. So that just gives me an idea about the incorrectness of wasting my time and energy for something like that anyway. And I think it's a plan to suppress the interest of what the subject matter really is and should be: the global system of race and white supremacy, the non-white black male who was murdered a few days ago is one of the many examples of the global system of race and white supremacy, I'll put it that way. And this is designed basically is to not have a continuous focus on that subject matter. And that's basically what I was wanted to report. Thank you. Also, Hollywood is going to have a field day with remnants of this. I can see it being a quote-unquote interracial couple, black male with a white female, and the white female is wearing a T-shirt that says Black Power in the movie. I can see that going on from this right here. The movie will start within about a few months. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. I think field day might be a metaphor.
My mistake.
Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and the listeners. This is in Yame, Nebraska. I have a couple quick observations and a question I wanted to ask for anyone who can answer the question. The first observation I've noticed revolving around these protests and riots was I've heard several television personalities who spoke on the matter as having a backdrop against COVID-19 as if these things are worse because of the conditions created by COVID-19, people being locked up in their houses. There's been a lack of access to adequate resources for many people, and that's increased the frustrations, which led to some of these incidents as well. So I was just wondering, what other people would have thought about that observation that they were making. And also with the two incidents that have happened around here, I've heard the chief of police in this city give an interview about those incidents. And what I've noticed is that there seems to be a focus on isolating this particular incident, as in not connecting it to all the other murders, all the other acts of white supremacy that have caused similar responses within the people. And I was wondering if there was a codified terminology for that. It's kind of like obfuscating or conflating, actually, but in the reverse, for having the same effect, causing confusion, where they would like segment a certain situation to confuse people about the situation in whole. So I was wondering, because I'm looking through the word guide, and I'm not seeing a term in the word guide that relates to that. I could be overlooking. So I was just wondering if there was a terminology which would fit having a more precise definition for that. But that's all I wanted to say. Thanks for letting me share, and I'll mute my line.
Much obliged, Inyame in Nebraska. Incidentally, I just checked the news really quick, and it looks like things got really bad in South Carolina. And, I saw a lot of whites out in the street running around, signs, Black Lives Matter, Black and I'm Proud, like they were clowning all the way. In fact, it was so many individuals looked like they'd be classified as white. I thought, wow, like they should have had like an infantry, like Dylann Roof shouldn't have got on the front porch of the church. Like all of those whites should have been like, hey, get away from round here. Like we are protecting Black Lives Matter. Get away from round here. Like what in the world? Where did all these, you know, white allies come from? My thoughts, these incidents happen all the time. Like there was no Rona in 2014 when there were so-called protests and riots. There was no Rona in 2016 when there were protests and riots. I don't think there was any quarantine that James Brown was talking about in Augusta. I mean, all of this is a part of white supremacy racism. Now, I am sure people are a little more stressed and a little more anxious with the virus situation that's happening right now. So I'm sure that is some factor. But I mean, I think President Obama, or I know President Obama said it. I think he said it when it was also in Minnesota. Philando Castile, 2016, when they had all this. And he said, either we can solve the problem of white supremacy racism, or we'll have these type of, you know, incidents sporadically, you know, every few years. We'll just, you know, get ready. It'll be right. Oh, Negro was killed in Las Vegas. Oh, maybe got one in Cincinnati. Orlando, you said. Oh, okay. Chicago this time. Mm-hmm. Saying, oh, they got one in Cincinnati. You know, we'll just have that, and there'll be, you know, protests and riots every few years or so. That just happens. That's a part of white supremacy racism. I said that with Ahmaud Arbery. Can't blame this on the Rona. On the Rona. The sickness, Andrew Young. The sickness is white supremacy. Mr. Arbery was killed before the Rona even started. And I think the same with, or at least it had not started in earnest in the U.S. Like there weren't all the lockdowns and all that stuff at the time that Mr. Arbery was killed. Same thing for Breonna Taylor. All that stuff happened in like March. In fact, I think Ahmaud Arbery, I think that happened in like February. So, yeah. Small contributing factor, but the problem, the sickness, white supremacy racism. Other folks who dialed in, if other folks want to respond to Inyame's question, you can feel free as well. You can get other perspectives. I think that was open to everybody present. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if we missed you totally, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. So I think this was the, I think his name is Cooper, the Cooper clip that you played. I heard the reporter, like, she lists his accomplishments, and then she said he happened to be Black. And I was thinking about that phrase, and I don't think I really hear that phrase, the person happened to be white. So then I started thinking, like, when that phrase is used, when you, like, okay, he has all these accomplishments, but the reason why that happened to him is because he was not white. And because he's not white, he's not allowed to have, I guess, not to be seen as a human being or to be treated a certain way. That's what I got from that. And I never thought about it before, that phrase happens to be Black. So because you happen to be Black, that means that, you know, you should be mistreated. And I found it very interesting, too, about just this idea that this lady is separate from the system of white supremacy. Like the way her job fired her as if the company that she works for doesn't practice white supremacy. And another thing that I've been seeing to a lot of white protesters, and I agree with retired firefighter. I never even thought about that word, and I want to thank him for saying that word. I haven't thought about that word for a long time, rebel. And that's what I saw, too. I was like, these people look like, you know, they've been locked down for a couple of months. You know, they're bored. They want to, like, party or something, and going out, throwing rocks, throwing, like, you know, like, they're having fun. That's what I see when I see the... And I use protest in quotes because I don't know what is going on with that because I'm not really hearing any good demands. I'm just seeing people. Anyways, the other thing is in the Georgia, Glynn County, Georgia, they made a statement about a silent war. I think that's a metaphor. I don't know. But I wasn't sure what that meant. And I always thought that a caste system was similar to a class system. I never associated caste system with racism and white supremacy. So I ended up looking up the etymology of the word, and it said that it's mid-16th century from Spanish and Portuguese, casta, which means lineage, race, breed, pure, unmixed. And I think that's all I wanted to share. Thank you.
Love it. Checking the etymology dictionary, one of my fave pastimes. Just thinking about that phrase, and happens to be black. That is when I have to pay attention to see if they use that at any time, give someone's accolades and a professor and author, stamp collector, squirrel watcher, happens to be white. I'm going to have to see all the times that I can think of, it's happens to be black, happens to be a non-white person. Like, yeah, I have to ponder on that. I forgot to respond. I believe it was Inyame's other question. He was saying that when they talk about these incidents, when they've killed a black person, whether enforcement officers or whatever, badge or no, if they've killed a black person, he was saying that they were having these discussions and they were trying to kind of reduce it. Minimize it. This is an isolated incident. That sometimes the metaphor that they'll have, few bad apples, you know, in this police department, or, you know, this is an anomaly. You know, this is not representative of the collective, right? The term our caller in Florida coined, I've been using it. I think it's accurate. Racial focal pointing. That's in where they will discuss racism, white supremacy, and as opposed to saying, what does it mean to be white? It'll be, no, the racists are the Klan members. See, we got all this racism because we got Klan members and skinheads. Or they'll say, we got racists because we got, you know, these right wingers. You know, we got these extremists. We got the conservatives. They'll do it that way, or they'll find lots of just making it really, really small subsection. It's not all white people, and it's not even most of them. It's just this little tiny group. See, we got another metaphor there. We just got a few bad actors. See, it's just a few bad. We got a Dylann Roof here and a Daniel Pantaleo here and an Amber Geiger. You know, we just got a few. They'll do it a lot of different ways. Sometimes they'll do it. We got these geriatric whites. See, once we can get rid of Donald Sterling, he can slip on a bar of soap or whatever it is, and we get rid of these, you know, these old farts. Once they get out of here, hey, no more racism. All the young white people, they love Obama and they listen to Jay-Z and Beyonce. So no more. Lots of different ways that they do racial focal pointing, where it's just a small little subset of white people, as opposed to what does it mean to be white. Other folks can think if they have a better term or a better way of describing the phenomenon that Inyame was detailing. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I believe we have about a half hour or so, maybe a little more, left in the broadcast. If you think you have comments, observations, questions to share, *61, we will get you on the line. If you have any reports, if you were out at any of the events, have observations, feel free to share. Folks we missed, proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Ohio.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. I know here over the past couple of nights, there has been protesting. Today, there was an uprising. I'm going to call it an uprising, not a riot. And there was a, well, there was a curfew enacted in Columbus because of the uprising downtown. I have been hearing over the past couple of days about how other people are describing the uprising as rioting. They're like, you know, rioting and tearing up our communities doesn't help or anything like that, but it's almost, but it's not necessarily our communities. It's basically places where we're housed, and the businesses, they're not necessarily Black owned, I guess you would say, and they're also anti-Black. So I was, you know, thought that that comment was curious to me. The but I guess just to go back to the protests that I've seen, seems like there's a lot of younger people. I'd actually end up inadvertently driving by one, and they had their signs out. I didn't know what was happening until I saw on the signs. I just saw a bunch of people just standing on a corner and in like a parking lot. But it seems like, I don't know if someone like the younger people, they maybe weren't taught the complete lesson. And I guess you can, you know, blame that on the inadequate school system, but they weren't taught the complete lesson about protesting, which it's not, the protest is not the, you know, the end result. It's basically what you gather from the protests, forming groups and, you know, starting other counter racist activities to try to resolve an issue, try to resolve it, maybe like the most pertinent issue, or, you know, try to resolve the global racist issue. So I'll leave it there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Well, that's interesting. I think some other folks have kind of raised that, where they were saying that they didn't really see like a list of demands in terms of what exactly do they want to happen as a result of all of this. What do they want done? Like, they haven't really seen that articulated, which is, I think, something that has been expressed before with some of the more recent times where they've had these activities, marches, protests, however people are labeling them, where there didn't seem to be like a clear articulation of, you know, what exactly do we want to take place? What do we want to be the result of this? But yeah, that's important as well. These are not communities. Say that such a frequent basis. We do not have communities, victims of racism. We just have areas where we are warehoused, areas where we are allowed to reside. That's what we have. Those are not communities, even though I still see a logic in not wanting to, you know, be disruptive in a place where I reside and or a place where I am dependent on getting my resources. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up.
Can I say one more thing?
Let's see.
Just real quick, I guess it would also be a comment and a question. The comment is, I've actually been hearing gunshots in the neighborhood where I'm currently warehoused, and I didn't know if anybody else was hearing that too. It doesn't seem, it sounds like gunshots. I didn't hear, like, it's been happening since Memorial Day. First time we heard it on Memorial Day, thought it was maybe like the crackers, but now it doesn't make sense for it to be happening again now. So I didn't know if anybody else was hearing that too. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Wow. That's one of the other many reasons that I've said, because, you know, at these events, you have to be prepared for anything. They had 7 people shot in Louisville. I know there were shots fired in Minnesota as well. Like, there have been so many reports of shot here in Seattle. They had images and video there was a white man, he looked like he'd be classified as white, with an assault rifle. And then another white man with a pistol came up, pointed the gun at him, and disarmed him. Like, and this was all happening in the middle of the street, broad daylight in downtown Seattle. Like, to have that sort of thing happening, I don't know if this is, you know, folk revelers, as retired firefighters said, like, oh man, we're just having fun. Isn't this great, running around? When would we be allowed to run out in the street with our handguns? Thank you so much, George Floyd. Hope they kill someone every week. This is great. I don't know if that's what's happening. I don't know if these are undercover enforcement officers. Like, I'm good. I'm not surprised at all, though. I would probably, I mean, if it sounded like gunfire, I would trust your instincts, because it's been so much of that. You already said you've seen protests. So yeah, I would trust your instincts and stay safe. But there's been so many reports of that across the land, gunfire breaking out and all of that. So yeah. If other folks have what you've heard or input on that, feel free to share there also. Let's see. Other folks that we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed.
May I be heard?
Caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners, and callers. I wanted to start out with, I think, the segment on the non-white people. I believe that was in New Mexico. I think I heard them say that the indigenous people or Native American made up for either 50 or over 50%. Either the deaths or the cases, maybe the deaths, but races have control over pretty much all of that, and they have the resources, they have everything in connection with themselves, how to restore people to health. And if you're non-white, there definitely is a high likelihood that you don't have those same types of accesses. Same type of access that they have. And as far as here locally, mainly it was in, I think it was in Daytona, they were talking about the Memorial Day related celebrations, so to speak. And after all of the images of white people in large gatherings being careless, reckless, and making comments like, oh, if you don't want to come to the party, then you can just stay home. You don't want to catch it. You know, you ain't got to come here. All right. Total carelessness, you know, irrational thinking and logic. I mean, irrational behavior. They put all kind of emphasis on a group of black people going to, I guess, the beach. And they use the term, I don't know if anybody heard this, a gauntlet. They use the term gauntlet. And I'm thinking about some type of wrestling match or something. And that's the word they use to describe a black group of people gathering together, okay? But they don't use those kinds of terms to describe white people. Even though they're not even, I don't even think, reporting all of the context of the people who have contracted the virus just in the area of Missouri. They say, oh, one person tested positive. All right. And they'll report it as, well, there's a lot more people that was exposed. So they definitely are very cautious in how they report when it comes to reporting about the white people. And quickly, there was a protest that happened called, I guess, the March for Freedom downtown. And it started with someone that posted online. They said, you know, I'm just so frustrated with this. The person that started this, and she said it was a black female victim of racism. She said, I don't know what to do. That's what she said. I don't know what to do, but I just want to be loud, and I want my voice to be heard. That was it. So if anybody just want to come gather with me, and we can just march from a certain block to another. And apparently it got a major response of like 3,000 people. So this happened today. And apparently a suspected racist got in his vehicle and attempted to drive through a group of protesters. And I guess some victims, or it may have been some white people mixed in, approached the person's vehicle, a white man, and he had a gun. And he pulled the firearm out and waved it at them. And I guess continued to try to drive on, but the race soldiers, I guess, caught up to him. And apparently from the news reports that I've seen earlier, they had the person just sitting down on the, you know, on the edge of some kind of bench or something. Like, I didn't see nobody roughing him up. He had handcuffs on or whatever, but he looked relaxed to me. But yeah, like, I agree with that point of you should expect very awful things to happen if you go to participate in something like this. But my last point would just be that this is a cultural system of racism. And even though they'll happen to arrest and charge the officer that's mistreated and murdered Mr. Floyd, keep in mind, if anybody seen this, there was a uniform army of officers, I think, that was outside of his house, and it was organized and it was structured, and they had a barricade blocking people off. So they still have that system right there, even though they try to make it seem like, oh, well, things will change and we'll try to do better, but they still have that army there, or that connection of racist white supremacists. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, sir. That sounded like an army to me. I thought you were correct the first time. If you have a phalanx of armed race soldiers out in front of your residence, I don't know, badge or no, that sounds pretty close to an army to me. The situation with the victim who posted online that she didn't know what to do, which is many of us, you know, it's a difficult problem, white supremacy, racism, that she wanted to be loud and she wanted to be heard, and 3,000 people responded.
Yeah.
Wow. We had a black female on the program in 2018. She was talking about racism, and she said she put an event together and she didn't even spend a whole lot of time thinking about what to title it. Like, that's what I mean. Race soldiers, they practice their riot response. They have training for riot preparedness. We frequently, I'm not insulting, I'm just saying this happens repeatedly, where we, just what she said, don't know what to do. Just want to be loud and heard. Like, it's a substantial difference in how you arrive at that situation where anything could happen. The people who have trained for anything to happen in this situation, the people who just don't know what to do and want to be loud and heard. Wow. Just wow. Again, I would encourage not being present at these events unless you are prepared for anything to happen, and probably something bad. Just going back to the first port, the word gauntlet. What an interesting word. So the dictionary definition: go through an intimidating or dangerous crowd, place, or experience in order to reach a goal. The sentence example they give, they had to run the gauntlet of television cameras. The next is even more interesting. Second definition, as a noun, gauntlet: undergo the military punishment of receiving blows while running between two rows of men with sticks. Almost kind of homoerotic a tad. So either use of those words with black people going to an outing, were they jousting, beating people, like intimidating and dangerous? They always find ways of weaving words in that suggest the dangerous intimidating. That bird watcher at the park, he's intimidating, scowling as he was looking for the sparrow. Like, they always find ways of describing us in that manner, but the gauntlet. Very skillful. That's what I said. Words are so important. Be very mindful of that. The previous caller also who pointed out, she said, "I just happens to be black." Be very mindful of the way that words are used in the system of white supremacy racism. It is not an accident. Much obliged, caller in Florida, gauntlet. Let's see. Other folks, folks we missed totally, if you have a hand up, proceed. Folks we missed completely, did we nab everybody? We have about 15 minutes left, so hopefully folks will not be hanging out till the last minute.
Can I be heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. White people, shout off a huge white phallic symbol through the air today, going to space. Using a method they haven't used since black women was doing all the math for them. So we get to see in 180 days if their computers worked as good as ours did. You know, hopefully ours still work that good. I believe that white people are all working together to maintain a system of white supremacy. And unfortunately, it's the hardest conspiracy theory I have to prove. No one believes it. That's why I'm glad the black male got the white woman on tape. I was glad to send that around. And she was definitely not confused. She even cried. I started laughing. The number one thing white people were concerned about at minutes after that thing, that tape circulated on the news here, they called into the show. And one by one, I say 8 out of 10 of them, was concerned about the dog. Which I heard that they had the ASPCA take from her. Very dangerous in protests when you're black, and especially if you do it with white people. And that just shows how dangerous that book, The Hate U Give, was. Remember the white female guest who was protesting in Ferguson. She came back on the show multiple times, had a black child and a black crackhead husband. These are the type of white people that sometimes you encounter. If white people were serious about stopping racism, the last thing they would be doing is walking around holding hands and signs protesting with black people. I think they have a real clear understanding that we have zero power. And they're just clowning us. I know that's a metaphor, but that's what they're doing by even walking with us. What I saw yesterday was white people who infiltrated the protest in Minneapolis with intentions to commit crimes and violence. Minneapolis is a Midwest stronghold for the white supremacist group named the Antifa, who are so refined racist that their mantra and motto happens to be Black Lives Matter. These white people had the police station on fire. They were setting police cars on fire. They were using guided munitions and fireworks, which is something I never saw used in all of the protests I've seen before with black people. Then the white supremacists in charge, the white government, said that they were going to send in the National Guard yesterday at 8 o'clock, and they were enforcing a curfew. The white people said all day they weren't following the law, they weren't observing no curfew, and at 7:59, the white supremacists in charge backed down. They said because they were ensuing gunfire. I never seen this happen to black people ever. And I don't call Minneapolis a stronghold for black people. They let those white people and a handful of black people. And based off the demographics of Minneapolis, most of them would be probably from the country called Somalia. They burned and looted with impunity last night. No one was there. And I was kind of mad because I popped my popcorn and had my beverage ready. I canceled all my plans. I was expecting to see white people get the Selma treatment, but they didn't even get shoot a rubber bullet at the white people at all. But they focused their cameras on Atlanta, black people, while the whites were running around lawlessly in Minneapolis, looting and doing whatever they were doing. Black people, young black males mostly, focused on harming police, backed the police up into the CNN center, not in a trap, downtown Atlanta. And I said, whoa. So I did get to enjoy a little bit of my popcorn. I observed a white man take over the lead of that rally and started slamming his skateboard into the glass window, even so hard he even cut his finger. And I said, look at this. They infiltrated even in Atlanta. So then I turned and another channel, they had people at the White House gate, black people playing tug of war with the barricades with D.C. police and the Secret Service. And I don't think they really wanted to pass that barricade. But I saw white people throwing projectiles at the police and the Secret Service agents, even 30
seconds.
A few of them. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Much obliged. See if we can get B in Toronto in. I saw in Las Vegas, apparently the same thing is taking place. They reported that white people, just repeat what Thomas in New York just played, just insert Las Vegas, or excuse me, Reno, Nevada. They said that the protest was completely peaceful at first, but there was white people who came to be destructive just because they wanted to, not because of the cause. And then below, it has video. just replay what Thomas in New York said. Skateboards. And they got video and everything. It looks like an individual, very pale, would probably be classified as white, in a black hoodie with a black backpack, going up the steps of City Hall. And they got one with no shirt on at all, totally classified as white. And it's a whole mob of them. And they're going up to City Hall with their skateboards and breaking windows and all the right now. Again, if you can imagine, move members in Philadelphia. Never mind. Be in Toronto. Hope you are doing well, hanging in there. Are you all right?
Greetings, Gus. I'm doing right poorly, but hanging in there as much as I can. Again, thank you so much for checking in. I greatly appreciate it. That the times are trying, as I'm sure that for yourself and many of the callers and listeners, having to go through this trauma, although vicariously, and sometimes even in the plantation and day-to-day life, it can be very difficult, but to do what you can for self-care. I echo the very sentiment that retired firefighter Thomas in New York and others have mentioned. It was quite interesting with the protest. It started from Christie Pitt to Queen's Park. It ended up ending early because there was a lot of police presence, and there was concern that it might be more unsafe for protesters as the police were looking quite intimidating. In addition to that, I noticed that there was a lot of white people. I mean, that I'd have to say that the tone of which Minnesota had or Minneapolis had taken in terms of how to approach it was quite interesting, and it seems as if whites globally seem to be on board with this and watching, you know, this the strategy, because I noticed unlike the other cases, you know, you have the mayor and the governor talking about, oh, we validate the voices of Black people, and we understand their quote-unquote primal urge to just scream when a human life is being taken away in front of their eyes. We just want to make sure that, you know, the concerns are heard, but we also need your help to keep our city safe. And my offspring informed me of how one of the agitators who initiated the quote-unquote looting happened to be a white police officer who was outed by either an ex-fiance or an ex-wife, and also outed by friends, and that they had identifiers. So unlike the Hawaiian shirt in Minneapolis, the identifier was a black umbrella. There are agitators that I noticed that were in the protest, and they also have different symbolisms as well, which was interesting. There's for the protest, the young woman, Regis, who was allegedly pushed off a balcony by police, they had her classified as Black and Aboriginal. So you had Black and Aboriginal protesters and other protesters, pardon me, there as well. The interesting thing about the Aboriginal community is that if they are fair complexion, they like to say they're Aboriginal, but they identify as white. So that, hence the reason as to why there was a lot of white protesters there. And they seemed quite agitated and ready to start some damage. So that was also another reason as to why the protest dispersed early. Pardon me. The other thing that I noticed that was really interesting is they were saying the line of questioning from reporters, the same questioning that they had for celebrities and others who are connected with Mr. George Floyd, how do you think African-Americans feel, is the same question that they had for all the other innocent persons who have been murdered in some way at the hands of white people. And I just found it really interesting that they keep saying, asking the same questions over and over again. What would you like to communicate to white America? And I'm like, in one of my comments, I actually written, you know, if these are the same line of questions that were in the Shamar Rice situation, Sandra Bland situation, Eric Gardner situation, and so on. And if you guys don't seem to get the answers because they seem to be the same, then it's you're recklessly and blatantly choosing to disregard any concern, and that you are deliberately saying that you choose to see Black people as non-human. Because just tired of the same the same questions. And so yeah, I leave the line and try to stay strong, stay healthy, and keep safe.
Doing our best to be in Toronto, you as well. Very good to hear from you. Glad you were safe with everything happening today. White people, that's just for me, anytime there's supposed to be an event dealing with racism and there are individuals classified as white who are present saying, oh yeah, I'm with you, brother, I'm kind of turned off immediately. Like, yeah, let's go. we'll have to see how all this plays out. That just turns, I get a bit nauseous and very incredulous from the very beginning.
Oh, Josh, may I add one more thing real quickly?
Let's hear it.
Sure. The other thing that I thought that was really interesting was there is a commentary, because I noticed that a lot of Black reporters or those who have been guests on other media outlets, they seem to be appeasing the white people or making a plea or a case for white people as to why Black people are human. And the other thing that I started noticing
is that during that time, you have some of the white people saying, this is why white people should use their white privilege in order to vocalize the horrendous nature of this. And I just had to laugh because I'm going, the whole reason why this so-called white privilege under a criminal enterprise is occurring is because of white supremacy. So, of course, by them not doing what they're supposed to do is upholding white supremacy. I thought that was just really interesting. It was deception in art form. Thank you, and I leave the line.
I mean, black people are often punished for talking about racism. We heard Dr. Welsing today. I was listening to the archives of her talking during these same type of events back in 2014. And she was saying, you know, she was talking about when she was denied tenure and mistreated at an HBCU, Howard University in Washington, D.C. And she said black people are often punished for talking about racism. You have to do so in a manner that is pleasing to white people. So that can mean that can be manifest in a lot of ways. That can mean using the term white privilege as opposed to white supremacy racism. That can also mean, you know, saying things like that, like, you know, please, white woman, Amy Cooper, use your white privilege to voice these problems and issues. As, again, all of that, the foundation is you saying this to white people, they will hear something that they don't already know and will be moved to do something. They already know. They enjoy. They revel in mistreating Negroes. Very different. Articulating an accurate understanding of racism. White supremacy, which is hopefully what we, you know, stumble and fumble doing at this year broadcast, context of white supremacy. We should be here in the middle of the week. Seems so chaotic. Although, man, we have been rolling since the whole crisis. In the last 2 months, I think we have done 42 programs, which is, you know, quite a bit of broadcast time. Hopefully constructive. We have not just been here misleading folks and talking crazy in the midst of very serious times. But just stay tuned. The times and everything will be posted, and hopefully we'll have constructive content ready to roll as we begin June. Man, stay safe. We've got listeners reporting gunshots. I don't know if anybody else, if we get that in, you can feel free to speak up if folks are feeling that they're hearing gunshots in their area. I know here in Seattle they had enforcement officials. The sirens were whizzing by like right as we were getting ready to go live. I said I'm about 10-15 minutes from downtown Seattle, where it seemed like a lot of the chaos was centered. So I would recommend be very safe. Same thing I've been saying for about 2 months. There are many reasons to be inside, Rona notwithstanding. Not a good time at all to be out gallivanting, kicking it. I would be in the house for many reasons. If you got to go out, you know, it would be real strategic with where you're going, what you're trying to do. Check to make sure it's not any craziness. It's just, wow, it has been an extraordinarily dangerous and confusing year, and racist white supremacists are to blame for all of that. Sobriety would be best. Oof, we need every component of our brain computer, Dr. Welsing, working at maximum capacity, like all of our high-level thinking. We cannot just be inebriated and not thinking correctly, not being able to process logic. Additionally, I know a lot of folks are stressed. It is an extraordinarily anxious time worldwide. Racists heavily promote, you know, have a beer, have a glass of wine. We had folks talking about that on workplace racism yesterday. They will push their narcotics as a way to try to deal with all of this stress. Let's try to find healthy ways, the best ways possible to replenish, heal from all of this. As I said, let's get some meditation time. Let's get some yoga time. If you can get some outdoor time away from all of this, a little quiet reading time. Anything, if it's people that, you know, you can be around who are healthful. You know, you all talk about constructive things. You eat, maybe y'all cook, you know, constructive things together, whatever it is. But do that. Try to find healthful things that will replenish your spirit right now, because I know lots and lots of folks. Man, it has been an extremely challenging 2020, to put it mildly. Alcohol, narcotics, cigarettes, none of that helps deal with this at all. Frequently just makes it worse. In addition to being sober, be strategic. If you are going out, try to stay in if you can. If you are going out, you are alert, super mindful about who you are around, what's going on. Just dangerous times. See, the folks mentioned white person tried to run him over in the crowd. They went up and he was armed. Shouldn't be a surprise about that. You got a lot of armed race soldiers. Bad or no. You are sober. You're buckled if you're in a vehicle. If you're driving, you are not on the cell phone. You probably will have a lot of very anxious race soldiers with badges and guns. You do not want any reason for any unnecessary attention. Hands on the wheel, 10 and 2, as they say, not on the cell phone. Just trying to do the little things that we can. Whew, to stay away from racists, again, badge or no. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Stay safe. Stay safe. System of white supremacy is extremely dangerous for black people anyway. Whew. Be mindful of that and stay as safe as we can. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.